Good day, everyone, and thank you for joining us for day one of the three-day IMS 13 Technical Education and Enhancements and Migration Planning Teleconference Series. Today's teleconference will include a two-hour morning session followed by a one-hour lunch break, and we will conclude with a two-and-a-half-hour afternoon session. Today's teleconference is being recorded. In today's teleconference, we will cover the following topics: transaction manager enhancements in the morning session and system enhancements in the afternoon. At the end of the day, we will have a 30-minute question and answer session. If time does not allow us to get to your question, please send it via email to ibmims@us.ibm.com. Once again, that email address is ibmims@us.ibm.com. The speakers for today's session are Susie Wendler, Kenneth Blackman, and Dennis Eichelberger. At this time, I would like to hand it over to our first speaker, Susie Wendler.
Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us in today's conference. I hope that everybody was able to get a copy of the material. And if you noticed, if you downloaded all the materials that we were able to provide, we have over 700, just slightly over 700 pages of scripted material. So what we've really tried to do is put together a very comprehensive understanding of what IMS 13 provides you. What I'd like you to do now is move to the first section, the introduction, and go to page 5. So again, I would just like to remind you that this is 3 days, and today's session will be TM. After the intro, it'll be TM, and then this afternoon system. Tomorrow, it will be integration followed by application, and then a tool session, and on the third day, we'll have DBDBRC as well as installation and migration. Okay, so I hope everybody is now at page 5 of the introduction. I want to point out that when IMS provides a new release, IMS doesn't just look at defining new functionality and capabilities. IMS actually has several strategies that IMS development works towards fulfilling. In IMS 13, I want you to notice that these three strategies are to reduce the total cost of ownership, to continue the effort towards application simplification and enablement, and also, as always, to extend our lead in availability, scalability, and performance. So it's not just that those are strategies that we say, oh, we move towards those strategies. As you can see on this visual, IMS actually has put under each strategy specific functions that understand or that answer that need. So under reduced total cost of ownership, what you will hear over the next 3 days are examples of how IMS has reduced the MIPS usage to make IMS more efficient. We've even eliminated the requirement for you to do a gen just to change what you have in the security macro. If you have IMS and CICS communicating with each other, we have the option now for you to use TCP/IP instead of just VTAM for the underlying communication capabilities. And we allow you to also enhance a shared queues environment with a local first. We have some enhancements for IMS Connect, and we've also improved, as we do in every release, what the DIAG command can do. For application simplification and enablement, we actually have a lot of new functionality here. First is you can alter your HALDB and DEDBs without a database outage. We also have in IMS 13 logical versioning of your IMS databases. We allow your COBOL applications now to be coded with COBOL 5.1 to issue SQL calls against IMS DB. And for distributed environments, your .NET applications can access IMS DB directly. We also allow you to synchronously call another application, another transaction from calling IMS Tran. So, for example, Tran A in IMS can suspend itself invoke Tran B, get the response, and then have Tran A continue processing. That's been a long-standing requirement, and we answer it in IMS 13. We also make it easier for you to use the MQ bridge by providing an OTMA descriptor instead of requiring that you code an exit routine for asynchronous calls. And we've also enhanced IMS Connect. As far as availability, scalability, and performance, IMS has reduced some bottlenecks. There are several general performance improvements, and as we go through the functions that do that, we'll point those out. We've also increased the maximum number of application threads or regions from 999 to 4,095, and increased the number of uncommitted HALDB updates in a unit of work. And also, for those of you that are in the system world, we allow more user exits to be refreshable and specified in the list without having to terminate IMS and recycle it. So there are many new capabilities and enhancements in IMS 13. Those answer our overall strategies. Let's look at the packaging. So page 6. IMS's program number is 5635A04, and this visual on page 6 lists all the FMIDs of all the different components of IMS. I want to point out that only IRLM 2.3 will be distributed with IMS 13. So if you're using the IRLM, just be aware that you have to use IRLM 2.3. And then at the bottom of the visual, we have the IMS 13 component ID for retain, which is 5635A0400. Let's move to the next visual. Let's talk about software prerequisites. First of all, the minimum software level for ZOS is 113. If you are at a release prior to 113 and you're going to order a new ZOS, then ZOS 2.1 is orderable because if you see the note at the bottom of page 7, you can no longer order 113. So you have to migrate to at least 2.1. So if you look at the points on this visual, also understand that you have to have RACAP or an equivalent. So it's whatever security product you use. As always, we require the high-level assembler toolkit. And there are several APARs that are listed here. In reality, before you install IMS 13, just make sure you look at the PSP bucket and call the support center if you are unsure of all the PTFs that might be required. But again, what we'll try to do is point out specific things that you might have to install on your release as you migrate forward. Let's move to page 8. Some other software levels for optional functions. If you use Java, then it is JDK 6.0.1. If you're interested in the ISC TCP/IP support, that will require CICS 5.1, communicating with IMS 13. For those of you that are intrigued by the fact that we now support a COBOL program issuing an SQL call against IMSDB, our native SQL for COBOL requires COBOL 5.1 plus a few PTFs which add the IMS coprocessor function. And then in IMS 13, we have some other enabling PTFs also. If you're using our IMS Universal drivers, depending upon your environment, then we require JDK 6.01 or later, DB2 version 9 or later, WASP version 7 or KIX 4.1 or later releases. These are just the minimum releases for the Universal drivers. For .NET, our data provider in IMS Enterprise Suite 3.1 requires that you have the DRDA support for native SQL flows in IMS 13. So that just says you have to have the .NET ADO provider as well as IMS 13, and you will need to implement the common service layer, IMS Connect, Open Database Manager, and the IMS Catalog. On Thursday, we'll talk about the database versioning that will require implementation of the IMS Catalog. Let's go to page 9. Some additional minimum software levels. IMS 13 supports interactions with all supported releases of DB2, CICS, and MQ. The point here on CICS is simply that, again, if you're going to use the ISC TCP/IP support, which I will talk about right before lunch, then you will require CICS 5.1 and a minimum of ZOS 113. And if you have 2.1, that's even better. So, again, understand it's the supported releases of the product, of these different products, which can be used with IMS 13. Let's go to page 10 for hardware. IMS 13 only runs on 64-bit processors running in Z architecture mode. That's not new. That's been a requirement now for a couple of releases. So again, just be aware of the fact that the Z900 machines must be at GA2 level, microcode level 3G or later. So again, there is a hardware prerequisite. If you're using Sysplex data sharing, including data caching and VSO data sharing, you have to have coupling facility level 9, which is really an old release of the coupling facility, but level 9 or later. Page 11, shared queues and shared EMH support, again, would be coupling facility level 9 unless you're using system-managed coupling facility duplexing, which would require CF level 12 or later and bidirectional CF-to-CF links. Now, the final bullet on that visual, on this visual on page 11, talks about extended address volume support for non-VSIM data sets. This is actually introduced in IMS 12. But we do understand that some of you do migrate, do skip releases. So this is really, for those of you that are migrating from 11 to 13, or even if you were version 12 and didn't implement EAV support for non-VSIM, this is just a reminder that EAVs are supported at a minimum of DS8000 at microcode level 4.0 with some bundles or any later releases of the DS capabilities. So, again, these are just a reminder as you move forward into IMS 13 that there were some enhancements in IMS 12 that you might want to remember or look at our material for what we introduced in IMS 12. Page 12, we will support migration from previous releases. As always, we have DBRC migration coexistence SPEs, and on page 12, we have a list here of the APARs and associated PTFs for IMS 11 and IMS 12. For the security, since you can now remove the security macro, we actually retrofitted some SPEs to IMS 11 and IMS 12 so that you can actually go ahead and remove the security macro in those releases after you apply the migration coexistence SPEs. For those of you that are RSR, IMS 13 does support RSR migration coexistence from IMS 11 and IMS 12. And finally, in a shared queues environment on page 13, if you have mixed release IMSs in shared queues, then there is an APAR for IMS 12, APAR PM 75791 and the associated PTF UK 83421 that addresses some downward compatibility. And that is because we have the ability to obtain extended APPC OTMA synchronous headers only when you specify a DBRC minverse of 12.1 or greater. So again, this is if you're interested in APPC OTMA synchronous support with shared queues, where you want to set the XCF value to something other than N. Okay, that ends the introduction portion. And what I would like to do now is move over to actually go into the first major set of enhancements, and that is the transaction manager. So if you move to your handouts, please look for the ones that says TM enhancements. Let's look at that, and page 2 lists the topics, the TM topics, which include just a couple of enhancements to DFS NDMX0, which is the non-discardable message exit. I have a visual on an enhancement for MSC. Then we have a lot of OTMA enhancements in IMS 13. And then before lunch, I will end with a topic of ISC over TCP/IP. Okay, so let's skip page 3, which is a separator visual, to talk about the non-discardable message exit routine, to page 4. The non-discardable message exit routine, DFS NDMX0, just a reminder, this has been around for many, many releases of IMS. And it was the exit routine that was originally introduced so that you as a system programmer could alter the behavior when an application program abandoned and we automatically deleted the input message and sent out a DFS 555 iMessage. So many releases ago, DFS NDMX0 was introduced to alter that behavior so that you could send the input message to another destination to be reprocessed later if you needed. Now, over the releases of IMS, DFS NDMX0 has also been enhanced for many different capabilities. What we provide in IMS 13 is a new function for the exit routine to inform IMS to pstop an abandoned transaction, so therefore to stop scheduling but allowing queuing to continue. This is one of those functions that was introduced in 13 but retrofitted back to IMS 11 and IMS 12. So page 4 lists the APARs for IMS 11 and IMS 12. Now, more specifically, if you move to the next visual, page 5, what you can actually do, the 4 new things that you can do in the exit routine, is define a flag to tell IMS for this transaction that's abandoning to stop scheduling of messages like a pstop tran, or you can tell IMS, to, you can turn off a flag to tell IMS to stop input messages for a particular tran code as though you had issued a slash purge tran command, or you can issue a flag that would behave as though you had done a stop tran, or then you can also turn on a flag to do a start tran. So if you're interested in DFS NDMX0, there is a greater documentation in the IMS Exit Routines book in the Information Center, which, by the way, has recently become the Knowledge Center. So again, just a reminder, if this is something that piques your interest, please look up DFS NDMX0 in IMS 13. The benefits of that on the next page, page 6, is greater flexibility, especially if you have a high availability environment and you want greater control on how you might want to handle abandoning transactions. Okay, let's look at page 7. Page 7 is an MSC enhancement, just to let you know that there were some APARs that were introduced in IMS 13, so this is after GA, and retrofitted back to IMS 11 and IMS 12. And basically, if you have MSC links, so you've statically defined them, your MS link as well as MSP link macros can now accommodate up to 999 definitions. So 999 for your logical links and 999 for your physical links. Our SysID number remains at 2036. Okay, so this is just an increase if you need a larger MSC environment. Okay, so let's move to page 8. And here I want to actually start talking about OTMA. I have actually 2 visuals worth of enhancements, and I'll just briefly go through them. And they are the ability for OTMA to notify its partner clients, like IMS Connect and MQ, much earlier about the fact that IMS is terminating. There's also an enhancement to the global flood control to enforce a global limit value instead of just informing an MTO with a warning message. We also have the ability to display whole queue counts versus a primary queue counts when you're looking at the display upper command. We also have some more messages that not only go to the MTO, but also go to the WTO for automation. We have some enhancements for the OTMA callable interface if you are in a WOLA, Weather Optimized Local Adapter environment. IMS now knows about the different client types, the different, for example, the fact that IMS Connect versus MQ versus the OTMA callable interface are different client types. We have reduced the total cost of operation, so performance enhancements for OTMA, and we've got some enhancements to OR descriptors. On page 9, I'll talk about later on some of the enhancements for the IMS callout capability, and then there are some SPEs that I want you to be aware of. So let's go first onto page 10, which is the OTMA early termination notification. What this is on this visual is an autonomic enhancement for higher availability. So this says that our OTMA clients, example, IMS Connect, WebSphere MQ, the OTMA callable interface, are all notified earlier in the termination process. And why this is important is that over the years, what we've discovered is that as IMS is terminating, since the notification was later in the termination process, the shutdown of IMS, then what would happen is these clients would continue to send messages into IMS that could not be processed. So what we're trying to do now is really make the shutdown process much more efficient, IMS shutdown process, as well as prevent messages from coming in that can never be processed because IMS is terminating. This function is also being added to IMS 12 with APAR PM 73869. Let's move to page 11. So when IMS terminates, there are two types. One is planned and one is unplanned. So the planned outage would be when you issue a command like a checkpoint freeze, dump queue, and purge. What IMS will do is take advantage of a resource monitoring protocol that was actually introduced in IMS 11, the protocol was. And so in IMS 13, IMS takes advantage of this protocol and sends out a message during phase one of IMS shutdown to indicate that IMS cannot process new requests, and it informs clients to suspend processing for all T-bytes. For an unplanned outage, which hopefully would never happen in your environment, but this would be an IMS abend, then OTMA will issue a leave, an IXC leave, which leaves the XCF group immediately after the log buffers are purged. When that happens, an XCF, through its group exits, informs all the other members of the group that IMS is no longer active. So we tried to do this up front. So that makes it much easier to move forward and really prevent messages from coming in while IMS is in shutdown. Let's go to the next enhancement, and that is the OTMA Global Flood Control enhancement on page 12. So on this visual, I want you to notice that what I did is underline the word enforces. So this is a new option that enforces the global flood limit. And we introduced the global flood limit in IMS 11, but all it did was provide a warning message to the MTO. So now with version 13, if you do specify a limit, then new transaction input will be rejected, so that IMS will not go into a condition that could cause possibly storage exhaustion. So again, this is enforcing the limit rather than just being warned. So if you're not familiar with what we did, I just wanted to give you a little background about that. So let's move to page 13. In IMS 11, and by the way, it was introduced, we talked about it in IMS 11, but then this was retrofitted to a few previous releases, and that was the individual OTMA team member support. And that was that IMS introduced a default of 5,000 messages per team member, so individual instances of IMS Connect or MQ, for example, communicating with OTMA. And that was that if you didn't do anything, you had a 5,000 limit of input messages that were unprocessed. So at 100% of that threshold for individual team members, new messages were rejected, but we would give you a warning at 80% and 5% increments until release. So just to remind you that that's what we did a few releases ago. From a global capability, the idea here was that you could have multiple instances of an IMS Connect or an IMS Connect and a WebSphere MQ, for example, all coming into OTMA. Each one of them had that default or whatever you specified to override that maximum number of input messages. But the global flood said that you could also define a global value that would take effect as far as warning the MTO on the system console that there were now many more messages over and above what an individual team member. So it was a value that would that could be used to accumulate a maximum number for multiple instances of OTMA members. And the way you turn that on, the default was 8,000, but you could also specify a command, start team member, and you would say all input and then a value to override the default of 8,000. But all we did was when we hit it at 100%, the MTO would be warned and no input messages would be rejected. So what we're doing in IMS 13, page, if you move to the next visual, page 14, we have some new defaults. We have changed the global flood limit from 8,000 to 10,000. We have a relief value of 80% of that, which is 6,400, rather than a relief of 50% previously, which was 5,000. We've gone from 80% of 8,000 to 50% of 10,000. We have a new warning message at 80% and 5% increment. So the global value now follows the behavior pattern of what the individual members used to provide. So if you don't turn it on and you just want to use the default of 10,000, then all we do is warning. You actually have to turn on this request for us to start rejecting new input when you come to the global value. So the enhancements for this include that you can issue the command start team member all input. Now, note this is the same command prior to IMS 13, which now means that in IMS 13, in IMS 12 or 11, if you issue that command, that was to set a warning value, an override warning value. In IMS 13, that changes. That now will reject new input instead of just warning when we hit that value. If you don't want to do that, what IMS 13 also introduces, and I'll talk about this in a few visuals, is a new special OTMA client descriptor called DFS OTMA, where you can specify a value, and that would be a global value using a descriptor instead of a command. So let's look at this more into a little bit more detail. If you issue the command, start team member all input and give us a value, that not only provides an override for the 10,000, but also tells IMS that you want to enforce the global value and reject new input instead of just warn. So if you issue subsequently a display OTMA, then the command has also been enhanced to show under the global message flood capability server plus flood status under the user status column. Okay, let's go to the next visual, page 16. I mentioned that IMS 13 introduces a new client descriptor. So your descriptors are specified in the DFS YDT member of IMS ProcLive. A client descriptor begins with the letter M in column 1. Okay, and this is different. I'll talk later on about destination descriptors that begin with a D. So I'm talking about member descriptors, which is M. And ordinarily, this would be information for specific member client, like an instance of IMS Connect or an instance of WebCRMQ. In this case, when you say M space DFS OTMA, then IMS recognizes that this is a reserved keyword. It is a global descriptor, and you can have two values that make sense, input and MaxTP. For what we're discussing, input is a valid value, and it is the value where you provide the override, instead of 10,000, override number that you want for the global value. The MaxTP, I have that actually documented in a section later on, but the MaxTP is for asynchronous output, for its asynchronous T-pipes. So the DFS OTMA, a member descriptor, has two values that IMS will read. They're either input for this global number of input messages across the board for all member clients, and then MaxTP, which is for the maximum number of T-pipes for asynchronous output. Let's look at the next visual. What happens if you either say in IMS 13, start T-member all, and give us input value, or the DFS OTMA member descriptor with an input value. So again, at 80%, you'll get a DFS 3428W message. That's something your operators might need to see. At 100%, OTMA will reject all new input from any instance of an OTMA member associated with this IMS system. At 50% of the limit, then IMS will send a DFS 0793i message to the MTO in the system console, and that is a relief, and input messages will again be processed. The member flood control continues to be 9999. So I just want you to remember there are two values, the global and the member. The members for each individual instance of a team member client, nothing in there has changed. What has changed is the global value. Let's move to page 18. Some migration considerations. I just wanted to list this to you, especially if you're the person who's in charge of operator kinds of documentation. There are enhancements to the DFS 4388W and DFS 0793i messages. This is on page 18. So these might be possible changes to automation programs. And we also have new messages, DFS 3428W and DFS 3429E. Our default values for global limits have changed from 8,000 to 10,000, and the relief is at 5,000. The start team member all input command in previous releases only resulted in a warning. That same command will now turn on the request to reject new input once we hit that value. If you take advantage of our DFS OTMA, or actually because we have a DFS OTMA member client, the total number of descriptors for an OTMA client that you can specify in the DFS YDT, this is member descriptors, is 254 instead of 255. Some other migration considerations on page 19 is the fact that before IMS 13, just a reminder, okay, of what that means on a start team member all command. Start team member all input command, pre-IMS 13 only triggered warnings. The same command, the lower half of the page, is that in IMS 13, if you leave it at 200, you just wanted to know if you had 200. If you say that command, if you issue the command in IMS 13, then you will get a DFS 3429E message. If you do a display OTMA, you'll see a status of server plus flood condition, and any new input is rejected. Okay, let's look at page 20. So I had a lot of words prior to this visual. This is, I think I like pictures. I'm more a visual person. So I have two visuals, this page, page 20, and page 21. So page 20 shows you what we had in previous releases, the individual member level, where at 80% and then in increments of 5% up to 100, it would be simply a warning for the individual member. At 100%, we would reject new input, and then relief was at 50%. For the global level, all we gave you are warnings at 100%, and we would quit giving you warnings at 5% increments once we went down to 80%. In IMS 13, the lower part changes. Note that the individual members, so each individual instance of Connect or MQ, is identical in IMS 12, IMS 11, IMS 13. What is different is the global. Again, our threshold has gone from 8,000 to 10,000. That's just our default if you don't do anything. And if you don't do anything, and by not doing anything, I mean you do not issue a start team member all input command, or you do not code the M space DFS OTMA client descriptor, then all you'll get warning messages at 100%. However, if you actually turn on the global flood and you do want to limit it, then what will happen is that you'll get the warnings at 80%. At 100%, any new input from any member client will be rejected until IMS has processed enough to go below the relief level of 50% of your global value, and then we'll continue accepting new messages. So, I mean, that's important to understand, especially if you do want to control, especially if you're adding more and more members into your OTMA system, since your OTMA system can process many. The reason you would probably put a value like this into effect is because you're trying to prevent an IMS storage exhaustion in case there is a problem, okay? So this is really another level where you can prevent IMS from coming down because there is a problem. The problem could be that you have a runaway server that keeps sending in messages, or you have a problem in IMS where maybe you have some dependent regions that were not started, and all of a sudden everything is starting to flood in IMS. So you're really trying to protect your IMS environment. Just a reminder, page 22, when you issue display OTMA command, especially if you're using automated operations to read that command, then the length of the TIB and the input columns has increased to 5 digits. So the IMS display macro has been updated with a T27 and T28 D6 for the fact that we can now support 5 digits. Okay, let's move on. The next enhancement in OTMA has to do with whole queue clients. So what is a whole queue? Just as a reminder, if you're IMS Connect, if you're using IMS Connect, you may be familiar with what a hold queue is. A hold queue is a control block in IMS OTMA. It is a T-pipe secondary queue that is used to anchor all PCB messages, especially if they're chained to the first control block used for the IOPCB output, or they're send-only messages. Or it could even be a rejected IOPCB output, where you want to keep the IOPCB message. So what IMS has done is not change the concept of a hold queue. IMS 13 gives you more information if you've got a hold queue capable environment like IMS Connect, so that now when you issue a display team member T-pipe command, you now have separate commands for the primary queue and the hold queue. So these are, and again, when you see queue counts under the hold queue, Remember, these are output messages that need to be retrieved by your remote clients issuing a resume tpipe command, a resume tpipe flag in a message that comes into IMS Connect for IMS. Okay, now, this command output only affects non-shared queue systems because these are the output display parameter is mutually exclusive with what we have for shared queues, which are the sync and the queue count parameters. So again, the benefit of this is if you are IMS Connect, if you have an IMS Connect environment, we're trying to help you better analyze potential bottlenecks to differentiate between CM0, which is your whole queue output, and CM1 output, which would be on the primary queue. So let's look at an example on page 24. Here's our syntax. Display team member tpipe, and you can specify the tpipe, and you can now also key in the word output. If you do that, then what you could see is what's on the bottom half of this visual. So I have, if you notice, on the far right, I've got a status, and it'll either say primary or whole queue. And that's where you can determine if there is a queue count on the whole queue, that those are messages that have not yet been delivered and waiting for a resume tpipe. Okay, so again, this gives you a better indication of perhaps why your queue count might be building and the fact that it might be associated with an asynchronous output message. Let's go to the next page, page 25. What IMS 13 has done is not change these messages that are listed on page 25, and no change to the message context. What we are doing here is sending these messages that used to be only sent to the MTO in previous releases to now be sent to the WTO. So what this is to do, why this was done was to enhance automation so you can have additional console WTO messages that can react if you see these automation messages. So again, this is the list of messages if you're interested in looking at the WTO for automation purposes. Okay, let's go to the next visual, the O2MA callable interface. You know, the OTMA callable interface has been around for many releases since we introduced OTMA. What the callable interface provides is the opportunity for programs that run on the same LPAR as IMS to send messages to and from IMS OTMA. So this is an alternative. So we had several different servers that implemented the OTMA callable interface, or you could have written your own, that would talk directly to OTMA through this callable interface. This would be an alternative, for example, to a server that uses IMS Connect, or IMS Connect, which has its own XCF interface into IMS, OTMA, or even WMQ, the bridge, also comes into OTMA directly. So the OTMA callable interface was provided for other vendors that wanted to write their own OTMA interface, or in the case of IBM, if you have WebSphere Application Server, then WebSphere Application Server provides something called the WebSphere Optimized Local Adapter. And the WebSphere Optimized Local Adapter, or WOLA, uses the OTMA callable interface to communicate with IMS OTMA directly. So from that, using the WOLA adapters, you don't have to come in through either Connect or MQ. What IMS 13 has done is address a timing issue for asynchronous messages. So what IMS 13 provides is an asynchronous CM0 flow that says that if you're writing your own client or you're familiar with the way, let's say, WOLA works, then the OTMA send async API will now use the Send Only ACK protocol instead of an OTMA Send Async. So what this does is it's now stored, the message is stored in the hold queue in IMS. Remember, we just talked about the hold queue, which is what IMS Connect also uses, meaning that the OTMA callable interface is now hold queue capable client. Similarly, since it's now hold queue client, the OTMA receive async API under the covers has now become a resume T5 request against the hold queue. So what does that mean to you? That just says that if you're using a server that takes advantage of the callable interface, when OTMA NACs or rejects an input from an asynchronous message, then that client will no longer receive an IMS DFS error message. Instead, the server will receive a return code reason code indicating the specific error. And the return code reason code now is shown here at the bottom of this visual. So it's a return code 14, and then the reason code is, the reason codes are listed here to the bottom part of this visual. So that, as we move forward, just be aware, therefore, on page 28, that under the covers, IMS recognizes, or OTMA recognizes, that there are different processing considerations for different OTMA clients. So both IMS Connect and OTMA callable interface here on page 28 are hold queue capable clients and user resume TPOP request. WMQ is a little bit different in that it uses synchronized T-pipes for their commit then send messages. So this just lets IMS OTMA understand when it's informed about its type of client that there are different processing considerations. So as new servers come forward, then they can also tell OTMA what type of processing they will need. So this is an enhancement to the client bid process to allow identification. Now, one of the things that I wanted to point out here at the middle visual of page 28 is that I do have another type of client, and that's a synchronous program switch. And we'll talk about synchronous program switching within IMS tomorrow when we talk about application enhancements. Also, the OTMA clients created by destination routing descriptor for asynchronous output now supports WMQ. So prior to IMS 13, if you wrote a destination descriptor, instead of requiring an exit routine for asynchronous output, for IMS Connect, you could put all that information into a destination descriptor for IMS Connect by saying type equals IMS con. But for MQ, you continued prior to IMS 13 to have, we continued to require an exit routine, the DFSY, the destination resolution exit routine. In IMS 13, you can, if you choose, replace the exit routines with a destination descriptor where you specify type equals MQ series. Let's look at page 29, and I'll talk about that a little bit more, by the way, later. So let's look at page 29. There has been an effort. As I mentioned, one of the real key strategies of IMS 13 was to make IMS more efficient, and IMS OTMA has reduced its MIPS by several mechanisms. The first is a more efficient hashing technique for control blocks. Now, the impact to your environment will depend, and it depends because you'll see this enhancement or improvement depending upon whether or not you have a high volume of activity in OTMA. So, and specifically, if you're using CM1 or send then commit transaction input messages, then each one of those has a control block that is associated with the port. So what happens is that if you have high volume and some kind of a slowdown occurs, then we'll have a long chain of these control blocks associated with port. So this improved hashing technique allows OTMA to more efficiently find a specific control block associated with a unique message during application get unique or checkpoint processing. IMS OTMA has also changed some of the macros that it uses. So it uses the cPool and DFSBCB in the XCF message exits instead of the storage obtain macro. So this makes it much more efficient. What you will see if you're looking at storage usage, however, is an increase in IMS connects extended private by 167 megabytes, but 256K in the IMS control region. We've also removed the unnecessary move character long hotspot. But again, you know, what this results in is a greater efficiency in IMS OTMA processing. So, by the way, I should have probably mentioned this in the introduction. I assume you've all heard of the 100K benchmark for IMS 13. And this was part of it, was part of the benchmark was the ability to process IMS Connect and OTMA path length transactions in a far more efficient manner. So again, that is the reduced TCO that is associated with OTMA. Okay, let's move now to OTMA destination descriptors. Page 31, two enhancements. First of all, we now in IMS 13 introduced a type equals MQ series destination descriptor for your WMQ environment. So this allows your applications to do an insert to an alternate PCB where the destination is defined in a destination descriptor where you specify type equals MQ series instead of calling a destination resolution exit, the DFSYDRU0. And part of this makes it easier. Instead of having to maintain an exit routine, you can now put the information that you need in the IMS.proclive member, DFSYDT. It's just simply a question of going in and editing that member, and it is a sequential file. Additionally, we introduced for all descriptors, destination descriptors, the ability to specify whether or not the OTMA exits are to be called after IMS sees the information in the descriptor, in the destination descriptor, and then pass it on to the exit routine. So the exit routine can still be there for a final say. Additionally, to support these enhancements, there are corresponding changes to the IMS Type 2 OTMA DES commands, OTMA descriptor commands, so that when you create, update, delete, query the OTMA DES command, you can now define these MQ series, for example, capabilities, or change your exit parameter to say yes or no. These enhancements to the OTMA descriptor command, if you issue them on the fly, are recovered across warm or emergency restarts. If you want it to persist, if you want those changes to persist across an IMS cold start, then you will still have to change your member control cards in the DFS-YDT member of PROCLI. So again, the enhancements to the OTMA descriptors are threefold. One is to simplify asynchronous messaging for WMQ, remove the need to code the exit routines and maintain them, and that exit routines are the pre-routing exit and the destination resolution exit routines. By the way, just as a reminder, you have one pre-routing exit for an IMS system, but you can have multiple destination resolution exit routines. And we also provide the dynamic change capability with the Type 2 commands associated with these changes. So page 32, for MQ, what we've done is we address a requirement here to support MQ destinations. Since in previous releases we supported IMS Connect destinations, we now support WMQ. The restriction is that we only support asynchronous callout for MQ insert all PCB. We do not support the ability for iCall to go to MQ using a destination descriptor. Okay, what does that look like? Let's go to page 33. If you look at OTMA, then this is the list of the MQ definitions that you can have. You can say type equals MQ series, and then the T member T pipe associated with your MQ bridge. And then, for example, user ID exit, yes or no, the default is no, whether or not you're going to use synchronized T-pipe, the reply to queue manager, the reply to queue, your MQ report format, MQ report value, your MQ format, everything that you would specify in your destination resolution exit for MQ is also provided in this member. Okay, let's look at the next visual. The exit equals yes or no, and it defaults to no, specifies whether or not IMS will also call the MQ, this is for not just MQ, but for all destinations out of our descriptors, connect as well as MQ. Specifies whether or not the routing exits DFS YPRX0 and the destination resolution exits will be called. I want you to note that this requires PI 16243. So even after IMS was introduced, there are still some changes. So we're waiting for this particular A part to close. Once that does, then the description that I've given you about exit equals yes or no, being able to pass the information to your destination resolution exits if you want to call them with exit equals yes, and all of that will be true once the A part closes. Okay, for the type 2 commands, page 35, here are examples, query, update, create, and what we've specified here, if you look at this, is that we have the ability to now specify type MQ series, and then all the MQ values listed in the bottom part of the visual, as well as type equals IMS TRAN. And we'll talk about the type equals IMS TRAN when we talk about the synchronous program switching tomorrow. Okay, so let's go to the next visual, page 36. Note that your query OTMA descriptor now has some new type and show parameters, again, simply that we now include MQ series and IMS TRAN. Page 37 gives you an example of visual of issuing the change and then an insert to a destination of message 1. And in the OTMA descriptor, the DFS YDT member of ProcLive, I could have a destination descriptor with MQ asterisk, and that could just say anything, any specification of a destination that begins with MQ, or you could spell it out. You could have spelled out MQ M001, and we would pull the information out of the destination descriptor, send it to IMS. IMS would take that information, find the associated MQ partner with a T member as well as a T pipe, and then MQ would be passed all the information. And if you go this route, you notice now that we've used all the information from the descriptor without requiring access to the DFS YDRU, the destination exit routines. On the next visual, page 38, just to point out that the pre-routing exit routine and the destination resolution exit routines are also changed so that they understand that there is a descriptor from the OTMA environment that has information that it can use. Okay, so again, if you want to use both the descriptor and the destination resolution exit routine, you might look at these changes just to see whether or not the exit routine can be updated, or whether or not even needs to be updated to take advantage of that information. Page 39, just a reminder that the Type 2 command also supports all the new OTMA desk parameters. Okay, let's now go to the next enhancement, which is iCall. First of all, on page 41, we have a new receive some function for the iCall. Remember what the iCall was? That was a DO1 call that was introduced to allow an IMS program to suspend itself and with the iCall to send a message to a distributed environment and wait for the response. The problem that we had with the iCall, and at the bottom of the visual it says iCall send receive, is that if the application program specified a length that was not long enough for the reply, then IMS would tell the application program, you gave me a value of 100, let's say, but here's the real value is 125. And if the application needed all of that message, then it would have to reissue the iCall send receive, which would mean another network transmission. So in IMS 13, IMS provides a new receive subfunction so your program can be modified so that if it issues a send receive and it gets an AIB return code 100 or reason code and reason code Charlie saying you didn't specify a long enough length, then the receive subfunction, the program can issue an iCall receive to retrieve the entire message. And IMS will keep that copy of the entire message in the control region extended private storage so that your application program, when it issues this receive, doesn't actually go back into the network. It just retrieves the entire message from IMS extended private storage. So if you look at page 42, what we've done is that we have just given you a new subfunction, which is receive. So the iCall used to be just send receive, and now you can do an iCall, additionally receive. So the AIB OA use area for the receive call contains the length of the response area, and the OA length is used as the output parameter for the receive. Again, I like using examples, so let's look at page 43. At the top of the visual, I have an iCall that issues a send receive and put in the OA use area a response area length. Let's say it put in 100 bytes. The call is issued and the call receives a return code 100 reason code Charlie. And that is because the message was actually 125 bytes. But OAUs only specified 100. So what the application program can do is look at the OA len value in the AIB, and that will give the length of the entire response message, the real one, which would be 125. The program could then turn around and issue an iCall with an AIB subfunction of receive, and an AIB OAUs move in the value from the previous OA length, which was 125, and reissue the call. And it will be successful this time. So it makes it much easier, much more efficient to issue a receive after a send receive instead of having to reissue the send receive again with the correct value and go out into the network. So if you look at page 44, note that the receive is only valid if a previous send receive failed, because IMS won't have that message in control region private unless you had retrieved it initially. So that response data that you can retrieve with a receive is available until you issue another iCall with subfunction send receive. So it will override it if you issue another send receive. Or if the IMS application program reaches a sync point or a checkpoint for an EBMP or an abnormal termination. So we're not going to clutter up the IMS control region's extended private with a lot of these messages. You know, it's one for one. You issue send receive, it'll be there until you issue another receive unless you issue a send receive and then do a send receive and go out into the network again. Okay, another thing that we've changed in the iCall, page 45, is that there is a new field, an AIB field called AIB User Token, and it provides a specification of an 8-byte map name which will be sent out by OTMA to the callout destination. This was also retrofitted in IMS 12. And it's just a value that can be used and really means nothing in the processing of the IMS application as much as it would mean something to receiving program. It's a way the IMS application program can pass information to the receiving program so that it can use it, let's say, for a map name. So it's a value. If you're using Data Power with IMS and you use call out with Data Power, which Data Power supports, this is a way for the application program to tell Data Power what map to use to format the message to go outbound. Okay, there are some other SPEs. I just also want to move you forward to page 47. There was an SPE, and I wanted to point these out because these SPEs were relatively recent. So after the lifetime of after IMS 12 GA'd. So I just want to remind you that these are part of 13, but were introduced as additional call-out SPEs. The first one on page 47 is a support so that a remote server, when it sends a reply to IMS, can say send only ACK. So this requires some APARs and PTFs for IMS 12 as well as IMS Connect 12. And what this will be is for that call-out server to be able to receive an indication that the IMS application program actually got its reply, so that they can commit or abort their updated resources on the server side. So it makes it easier to do that handshaking. This is a visual on page 48. So on page 48, the initiating client on the right side of the visual says, I call, send, receive. It goes out through IMS Connect to the rollout. And in my example here is I have a roll your own server that can get the message and send the response back, send only ACK. Send only ACK tells IMS that when the application program gets the message to do an ACK, and that call out server is immediately notified that the message was received by the IMS application so it can go on processing. If that rollout server may be waiting for a response back so that it can continue and do some commits on their side. So again, it is a way to indicate delivery all the way to IMS. The next SPE, which is a call out send only ACK SPE, this SPE has no requirement for you to use it. Okay, so if you have application servers or if you have servers that are already doing work with IMS using callout, then there is no requirement for you to change that. This is on page 49, by the way. So it is just an optional capability. If you want to take advantage of the support, then your SYNCOUT callout server program has to change to perform an additional receive of the ACK NACS. It does a send only ACK, and then it has to turn around and do the receive to make sure that it did get an ACK. What I wanted to point out also at the bottom of the visual is, especially if you're going to a server that is a busy server communicating with multiple requests to and from IMS, then the callout server can use a separate sync callout request receive retrieval, that is a resume TPIP thread, for processing the response thread. So that would use a different socket. Okay, page 50, for IMS 13, this is an APAR for the callout send only SPE, and this is just all the information. The IMS Connect 13 APAR at the bottom of the visual, PI10653, adds a flag to allow the IMS Connect client to retrieve the request message text. And that just says not to be returned with the ACK, so that you're only getting the ACK and not the entire text. Let's go to page 51 for IMS Connect users. There is a socket enhancement if that remote program is doing a resume TPIP wait forever. So it's like a wait for input, so it's just waiting for more and more messages and just sits there waiting for message from IMS Connect. If that client that's done the resume TPIP wait forever terminates then IMS Connect is informed after the Keep Alive interval that the client session has terminated. So that makes it easier to release that socket, because that also affects when the IMS Connect session is in a con state waiting on a reply from the data store, simply because that remote client has said wait forever, so we're just sitting there pulling and waiting. So again, we'll clean up the environment if that remote client has gone away with this APAR. Okay, page 52 on. I have a lot of visuals here. I'm not going to go through them. I added these visuals into your documentation, which you can look at later. And I I'm going to just have you flip through these pages. And this is for the MAX-TP. So this is an explanation of the maximum number of T-pipes. And it was introduced in IMS 11 with base support, enhanced in IMS 11, and moved forward fitted to IMS 12 and IMS 13. So again, if you look at your pages 2, 52, and then 53, 54, 55, all of these, what I've done is shown you really the ability to understand this MAX-TP. And since it was introduced as a base in 11, enhanced in 11, forfeited to 12, and then 13, I just thought that for this class, I might just want to give you the information. And the main thing for IMS 13 is that the client member special DFS OTMA descriptor in DFS YDT can specify that MAX-TP value as an override value. Another thing that I wanted to do is point you to page 66. There is an OTMA, Transaction Expiration and Shared Queues SPE, just a reminder that these are options of when transaction expiration occurs whenever we do application get unique time. Remember, we introduced that several releases ago in IMS. We've got some improved capability of shared queues back and off PCB output, and the usability of the display team member T-pipe support. So this is on page 66, and some pictures and more information on page 67 and 68 about that capability. So let's move on into the benefits. I just want to summarize. So again, from those several pages in your handouts, I wanted to add as just additional documentation for you to read when you were looking at whether or not those application environments and those specific IMS Connect OTMA capabilities impacted you. So just to wrap up OTMA, on page 72, I just want to remind you what we've done in IMS 13. We have potentially reduced unsuccessful attempts to send a new request while IMS is terminating with our early termination notification. We now enforce the global flood limit instead of just warning you through a warning message. We have an ability to help you understand maybe when your cold queues are building up, if you've got IMS Connect or now with the OTMA callable interface, to understand potential bottlenecks for clients that have not retrieved their messages with a resumed T-pipe. We've also added WTO messages for automation. They're not new. They used to only be sent to the MTO. They're now being sent to the WTO. On page 73, we have changed the OTMA callable interface asynchronous capability to be more in line with the way IMS Connect works with asynchronous output messages over the whole queue and resume T-pipe. We have also made the OTMA environment more efficient with our MIPS reductions. We've enhanced the OTMA destination descriptors. Number one, if you're in a WMQ environment, you can now use destination descriptors instead of the exit routines. If you want to also use exit routines, we have the exit equals yes or no capability in the destination descriptor, and we have type 2 commands to be able to change any of those while IMS is processing. We've also enhanced the iCall support for truncated messages so that if your application program did not realize that the distributed program changed and not sending you 125 bytes instead of 100, for example, then what you can do is modify your application program to expect that there might be some times when it will only get a partial message because the change was made for the length. So now you can retrieve the entire length. Okay, so that's it as far as the OTMA-specific enhancements. What I would like to do at this point is continue with TM and move us into ISC over TCP/IP. So that begins on page 74, which is a separator visual, and then I'll now move to page 75. If you have CICS communicating with IMS and sending transaction messages back and forth, then you probably have ISC. I mean, you could have done it with other ways. You could have sent messages back and forth, beginning with IMS version 4 using APPC. But in many cases, what we've discovered is we still have a lot of ISC connections between CICS and IMS. So what we're doing in IMS 13 is allow you to continue unchanged if you have VTEM links, or to also add TCP/IP links or replace your VTEM connection between KICS and IMS with a TCP/IP connection. So actually that's a big enhancement in IMS TM. Especially if you're communicating with IMS and CICS using ISC. So let's look at page 76. What this is a new option for network connectivity for ISC. What this is it allows us to support TCP/IP as a strategic protocol in your shop, if that is your strategic environment, as an alternative to SNA VTEM. So it allows you to have an all-inclusive TCP/IP solution for your networks. If you notice, for many releases now, when we added IMS Connect, it was to allow you to come in directly to all your IMS transactions from distributed environments. So it was an alternative even to 3270 or 3270 emulation. And then we added support in IMS 12, we added support for you to change your VTAM links if you had them for MSC between IMS and IMS, so you had MSC over TCP/IP. By the way, just as a reminder, in IMS 12, we also allowed you to send asynchronous messages between IMS using IMS Connect and TCP/IP, so asynchronous messaging, one-way protocol between IMS and IMS. In IMS 13, we're now bringing our CICS folks into this mix because many of your CICS environments are now using pure TCP/IP. So we allow ISC over TCP/IP. Let's go to page 77. ISC over TCP/IP supports both static and dynamic terminal definitions in IMS. So those don't change. If today you have ISC terminals defined as statically in your sysgen with your type terminal, subpool, and vtempool macros, those will stay. What we've done is in the DFSDC member of ProcLive, we have the ability for you to specify a parameter to tell us which of those nodes defined in your static definitions are now to use TCP/IP instead of VTEM. Additionally, if you're using ETO, then we've made changes to the logon descriptors. So you can tell IMS to dynamically define the communication using TCP/IP to leverage TCP/IP. Between IMS and TCP and CICS, we use IMS Connect. So this is even another expansion of the use of IMS Connect in your environment. So there are enhancements to the HWS config member of ProcLive. Between IMS and IMS Connect, we use a common service layer to communicate between the address spaces. So that will require SCI and OM. Those are the two address spaces of the CSL that we would require you to have. We've also enhanced the IVP as well as syntax checker to support the CICS IMS ISC communication over TCP/IP. So on page 78, just a definition of our ISC topologies. We still support ISC VTEM. It's not going away. What we're doing is we're adding ISC TCP/IP connectivity between IMS and CICS. And if you choose to do that, then that requires CICS 5.1 and a minimum of ZOS version 13. So again, both VTEM and ISC and TCP/IP topologies can coexist. So let's look at page 79. This is the visualization. On the bottom half of the visual, it's what you have today if you're using ISC with CICS. It is VTEM, and you have parallel session support. You can start the communication either from IMS or from CICS. The top of the visual is what's new, where we now put IMS Connect in the middle, and we use SCI communications between IMS and IMS Connect, and now we use TCP/IP between IMS Connect to CICS. Again, the communications can start either from the IMS end or the CICS end, and parallel sessions are supported. Let's look at CICS, page 80. We take advantage of CICS IP interconnectivity, CICS IPIC, but we limit the communication from CICS if you start from CICS to programs that use the start retrieve logic. So that's asynchronous processing support when CICS is the front end. So you start from CICS. Additionally, since that's asynchronous processing start retrieve, then business as usual, that does not allow access to response mode trans or conversational trans. So we do not support a TIX application using send receive. They have to use start retrieve. On the other hand, if you start the communication from IMS, where IMS is the front-end system calling a KIX back-end, then the transaction support is identical, and the transaction flow has always been and continues to be asynchronous. The important thing to note is that no change to existing programs on either side of the connection is required, and that says that assumes that on the CICS side, if you're starting from CICS, that your programs are already using start retrieve. The next visual, page 18, is simply a chart of the functions on the far left side of the visual and transactions, what is existing in LU61 ISC VTEM support in the middle, and then what is supported or not supported in the TCP/IP link capability on the right side of the visual. Let's look at page 82. Page 82 shows you how you can initiate the request from either the IMS side, which is the top side, the top half of the visual, or the CICS side on the bottom half of the visual. On the top half of the visual, your IMS end user logged into IMS can either invoke a TRAN or can go directly to a message switch to where the destination is an LU61 node, a definition which will send us all the way through IMS Connect to TCP/IP and get the reply back. On the CICS side, your CICS end user, if they start the transaction request, so in this case IMS is the back end, then the program issuing start retrieve will send a message to IMS Connect over TCP/IP and receive a reply, again back at the CICS end. So either one can initiate the transaction. As far as parallel sessions, because ISC is all about parallel sessions, page 83, IMS applications support a session or a subpool level in both ISC VTAM and ISC TCP/IP. So if you've been used to the VTAM support with IMS, you understand that that's all subpools taken out of the VTAM pool. And we understand that and support that also in the TCP/IP world. CICS applications support session level in both ISC VTAM and ISC TCP/IP. So both support parallel sessions. Let's look at the next page, page 84. As far as communications with VTAM, and just a reminder of what it's like, you know, and everything is all about definitions. So let's look at IMS on the left side of the visual. You would specify your IMS ID, which is Apple 8 in my example. And then I would have a type LU61 and then a terminal. And the terminal name here would correspond to CICS. So, for example, a CICS Apple ID. And then I would define subpools. And subpools would all be parallel sessions. So in my example here, on this visual, on the left side, I have two subpools named CAC1 and CAC2. So these are two parallel sessions between IMS and KIX for LU61. Look at the KIX side of the visual. On the right-hand side, we also have a connection from CICS to IMS where the net name is IMS's Apple ID, Apple 8, and the access method is VTAM using protocol LU61. Just like on the IMS side, we define two subpools. On the CICS side, there are two sessions where the net name on each of the sessions is the same as the subpool name on the IMS side. So in CICS, I have a net name of CAC1 and CAC2, which match the subpool names in IMS being CAC1 and CAC2. Okay, so this is definitions in for IMS, ISC, with LU61 VTAM. Let's look at TCP/IP, page 85. So this is not an application definition. This is definitions for the system programmers on the CICS side as well as on the IMS side. So note on my IMS side that I still have Apple ID, Apple 8, terminal name, KIXA1. I have the same definitions. I haven't changed. By the way, I added the VTAM pool here. The subpools are all defined under the VTAM pool macro in IMS because you can have multiple subpools and those would be pulled out of the VTAM, out of the VTAM pool for an ISC session. What is different in IMS is that at the very top left on IMS1, I have ISC TCP/IP. And that's actually, I'll talk about that a little bit later, but that is a parameter in the DFS DC member of ProcLab, which would list that CICS A1 out of the SysGen will not use TCP/IP. In the IMS Connect side, in the middle, I have a definition to define that says a remote CICS, which defines my connection to CICS, and then I have an ISC keyword, which allows me to define the fact that I will use SCI because I will have an IMS Plex definition, and I don't have all the definitions here. I just want you to see that the ISC statement defines a communication with IMS and how we go back and forth, and how we also specify a remote KIX statement here that will use the actual keyword remote KIX, also in IMS Connect, to communicate with CICS. On the CICS side, the CICS definition will be TCP/IP service, where it defines a port number 8891, and a protocol, IPIC, IP Internet Interconnectivity. And then for each of the subpools, it'll have an IPCon definition. So note that on the left side, in my example here now, TCP/IP, my subpools are named SP1 and SP2. And on the CICS side, I have equivalent definitions under IPCon, IPCon for SP1 and IPCon for SP2. And the other definitions there have to do with ports inbound into KIX and ports inbound into IMS, IMS Connect. We'll look at that in a little bit more detail. Let's look at the terminal definitions. It's business as usual for static definitions. This is on page 86. Type, terminal, VTAMPL, and SUPL macros, identical for either VTAM or TCPIP. What is different for TCPIP is a new keyword, as I mentioned, ISC TCPIP in the DFS DC member of ProcLive. And in here, that will specify which of the terminal node names in the static gen will be used for TCP, will use TCPIP. Any addition, modification, or deletion of the parameter requires a cold start. If you change it, and then IMS crashes, ERE ignores that change. Okay, so it's only a cold start, which will pick up the fact that you've changed it. For ETO, there is new logon descriptor information in your descriptors, and that is the ability, and I'll show you this here momentarily, of how to specify that we're going to use TCPIP as well as which IMS Connect to go to. So this next visual, page 87, again, now where I highlight DFSDC, note that the ISC TCPIP parameter that's in the middle of the visual, page 87, points out that CICS A1, the first value, is equivalent to a terminal name in the stage 1 gen. The second parameter, icon 1, is the name of a local IMS Connect, or the name of an IMS Connect that will be used for the TCP/IP connectivity. Okay, so that's, again, the stage 1 gen, everything is the same. It's this new parameter in the DFSDC member of ProcLive, trying to make it easy. So as far as static definitions, they have not changed, and that's what page 88 is all about. There's nothing new here. There may be parameters in some of the definitions that we will ignore because they were unique to VTAM. But you do not have to change your stage 1 static gen. Okay, let's move to page 89. For ETO, we would add a keyword, unit type ISC TCPIP, and local icon equals, and the name of an IMS Connect to go to. So, just again, two parameter changes in your descriptor, and IMS will use that descriptor information and create the control blocks dynamically. User descriptors are, all, as always, are optional. We'll default to DFS user as we would for any other ETO descriptor. Okay, so let's put that together a little bit more. Page 90. When I originally said that IMS used SCI, the structured call interface, to go to IMS Connect, that immediately implied that you would have the common service layer defined. So in our case here, for the common service layer, what you would implement is the structured call interface, the SCI address space, as well as OM. We would always recommend you use OM, Operations Manager, for commands. Additionally, in the DFS DF member of ProcLive, you specify in there an IMS Plex. So if you already have the common service layer set up, this is nothing new. I just want to point out that IMS is, if you have this defined, has a Plex name specified. Note that on the IMS Connect side, in the ISC set of definitions, a new ISC set of definitions for IMS Connect, you would also specify IMS Plex. And the team member of the IMS Plex would be the same IMS Plex name as you defined in the DFS DF member of IMS ProcLive. Additionally, if you're using static definitions, then it would be the local IMS Connect name, whatever you specified there, that's the target IMS Connect you're going to. Or if you had ETO, it would be the value in the local icon parameter in the descriptor. Those would have to match the member equals value of the IMS Plex statement inside the ISC definition of IMS Connect. And that's how that's all tied together. So they're now part of the same Plex. So that's the definitions that would be required there. Another thing that I do want to point out, and again, you know, I'm just trying to give you an overview. One of the things that I also want to point out and I didn't put here is that on page 90 is that another definition you would specify in the ISC is the IMS ID value of the IMS system that's part of this connection. Okay, page 91. IMS connects, HWS connect, HWS config member, therefore has a new parameter in the TCP/IP statement for the KICS port. That's what IMS will listen in on definitions or requests coming in from KICS. A new ISC statement, which is where we define the Plex, IMS ID, the definitions that are needed between IMS and IMS Connect. And also, it will point to a new remote KICS statement, which is where we have the definitions of the destination CICS that this IMS Connect can communicate with. Let's look at these in a little bit of detail. Page 92. The new KICS port parameter in the TCP/IP statement lists the ports that IMS Connect will listen in on for new requests coming from KICS. So, you know, it's in addition to your existing port definitions for other types of communications that are coming into IMS, for example, into IMS Connect from other environments. And then KICS port is uniquely for KICS communications from KICS to IMS. So what ports are you going to specify that KICS needs to know about that we will listen in on IMS Connect? Page 93. The new ISC statement, there's an ID for it, defines, there's a local IMS. Local IMS is the IMS ID that is specified for IMS. IMS is IMS ID. And then we have the IMS Plex name, and then the remote KICS. The remote KICS is the definition for which CICS we are actually going to go and specify. The remote CICS statement, page 94, is where we define CICS's port. So we're going to CICS's port. The other thing that I want to point out is reserve socket. You might want to reserve sockets for your communication between CICS and IMS because you want them always to be available and up and active. If you do that, then make sure that your max sock value that you already have for IMS Connect, if your IMS Connect is already active, includes this reserve socket. So if today you have 300 sockets and you want to add 10 for the CICS definitions, then make sure you increase your max socket to 310. Okay, so again, that's, we're just reserving sockets out of the socket pool. If you go to page 95, what I tried to do here is give you an example. So let's do this. On the top, TCP/IP, which is an existing definition, in IMS Connect, I've added two statements for KICS. That's, for example, KICS port, and I've just listed a variety of ports here for CICS. Two lines. I can have a variety of different CICS ports. Those are the ports that would be used inbound into IMS Connect. So IMS Connect will open that up and say, I am ports number 991 through 995. for CICS connectivity. Okay, so that's inbound into IMS. To go to CICS, the remote kick statement in the middle of the visual defines the port that CICS is listening on. So we're going to go to CICS's port 8891 and its host name. So it's port number and its host name, and then how many sockets we might reserve. The last statement, the ISC statement, defines, for example, the node, which is equal to the node that you would define in the terminal name statement in the IMS Gen or in the definition that you had for ETL. The local IMS is the IMS ID. The KIX port, 9991, see how that has to match an already existing KIX port defined in the TCP/IP statement at the top of the visual. This is inbound into IMS so that if a message comes from CICS on port 9991, then IMS, through this statement, will know that it's going to go to local IMS, IMS ID of IMS 1. So we know which IMS, because we could have multiple IMS systems associated with this particular IMS Connect. The remote kicks is the statement which allows us to point to the remote kick statement, and then other information about the CICS environment, and then the IMS Plex for this SCI communications. So again, those are the definitions that you would need to have in the IMS Connect side. If we look at CICS on page 96, here is my example. You have to have a TCP/IP service statement for protocol IPIC, IPIC, or IP interconnectivity. And then you would have to have the definitions for each of the IMS sessions or subpools. My example here on the right side of the visual says that TCP/IP service, and the name of the service is TS1, will listen in on port 8891 using IP interconnectivity, which is TCP/IP. And by the way, outbound back to IMS, we will have several definitions, one for each parallel session. So this IPCon SSN1, Apple ID SSN1 equates to the subpool name for IMS. Again, the host name for IMS, and IMS is a receiving port number. And the service that will be used is TCP/IP, IPIC, IPIC, the one at the top. So there are all kinds of parameters that you need to make sure that IMS and CICS understand correctly on both sides of the equation. Let's look at page 97. This takes advantage. ISC TCP/IP support for CICS takes advantage of existing CICS IP interconnectivity message formats and support. So first of all, something for you to understand, there are two socket connections per parallel session, one for the send and one for the receive on each side. From IMS to KIX, IMS uses its send socket, and KIX uses its receive socket, and vice versa, from IMS KIX, from KIX to IMS. To really kind of try to explain this a little bit more, let's go back to a picture. So I've got a picture here on page 98. Try to flesh this out a little bit more. And again, remember, I don't have all the definitions here. I'm just trying to make a couple different points. Just as a reminder, IMS on the left side, from the Apple ID, Apple 8, all the way down to the subpools, those are existing definitions. My example here is static. Those are existing definitions in the Stage 1 Gen. I've added, after cold start and it comes up active, ISC TCP/IP and the DFS DC member of ProcLive saying that KIX-A1, that terminal name equals KIX-A1 in the static gen, will now use TCP/IP, and it will use an IMS Connect called ICON-1. And by the way, that ICON-1 is the name in the IMS Plex statement for IMS Connect in ISC, in the ISC definition. So we go to IMS Connect 1. A message that is sent to CICS, look at that node CICS A1, because CICS is a big server on behalf of multiple requests and parallel sessions coming through. So we would have one ISC definition for each CICS that we're going to. We would also have a remote CICS definition called KIX1, and if you move your eyes up to the middle of the IMS Connect, that's remote CICS1. We'll use port 8891 to go to KIX. KIX will have port 8891 defined in a TCP IP service under protocol IPIC or IPIC. For the parallel session definitions for the messages, actually that flow back and forth, you'll have an IPCon definition, SSN1, that matches our subpool in IMS, and that uses port 9991 inbound back into IMS Connect for IMS. So once that's all defined and everything works, we can actually start a session. So we can initiate the session either from IMS or KIX. It doesn't matter. As long as the session is initiated, then messages can flow. So if you do it from IMS, you would issue an open node, and then the name of the node, in my example here, is KIX A1, and user, and then the subpool name. So if I have two subpools, like my example here has SSN1 and SSN2, then I would issue two commands, open node KIX A1 user SSN1 and open node KIX A1 user SSN2. On the CI, by the way, that's not new in IMS. You'd still do that even with VTAM, and it would be the VTAM flows that would occur. You could also initiate the session from CICS using the CICS CEMT command, and that is to start the IP connection from CICS. And that is to, you would issue modify against the CICS address space, CEMT start IP, and then the IP connection, which is our subpool, SSN1 acquire. And again, you would do that for every subpool that you would want to establish a connection. Okay, so again, those are the two ways you can enter a command. Now let's make a few things more complex here. So I've got a couple visuals just to give you an idea of what you can do. So page 99, my example here has an IMS system with three subpools going into an IMS Connect to CICS. And again, one IMS, one IMS Connect, one CICS. So this is the example of what we've been talking about to this point. And note that all the messages that flow from IMS to KIX will all go through port 8891, and all the responses will come back to port 9991 in IMS Connect. Let's make it a little bit more complicated. On page 100, I now have two IMS Connects, but still one CICS and one IMS Connect. By the way, I could have two IMS Connects, and the two IMS Connects could be on separate LPARs, but just for purposes of simplicity here, I've kept everything as under one IMS Connect. But note that if I have two IMS Connects, then I would have two ISC definitions, you know, one for each IMS. Because I only have one CICS, then I only have one remote KIX definition. So if the messages flow from IMS 1 to IMS 2, then all messages coming in to IMS Connect would find their appropriate ISC definitions, find that the remote CICS definition they would use will take them to CICS 1 to port 8891, which is why at the top of the visual I have all the messages that flow in from any of the four subpools going to CICS port 8891. And then as the replies are sent back, you know that information is kept in the headers, then the replies will either come back to subpools 1, 2, 3, or 4, supples 1 and 2 will go to port 9991, and supples 3 and 4 will go to port 9992, so that they go to the appropriate IOC definitions, and from there, looking at the local IMS, it will go to the correct IMS system. And by the way, they would probably all on this, be on the same IMS plex for the SCI definitions. Now, let's make it even more complex. Let's go to page 101. In this example, I have one IMS. I've combined my IMS systems. I used to have two IMSs. Now I've got one IMS system. All the four subpoles are in that IMS system, but now I have two CICSs where the requests from subpool 1 and 2 will go to CICS 2, and from subpool 3 and 4 will go to CICS 3. So note in this example that I would have to have two ISC statements, one so that the remote kicks definition would go to remote kicks, kicks 2, and the other to remote kicks, kicks 3. So I have a remote kicks definition for each CICS, and I would have to have an ISC definition that would match the ability to send messages to that remote CICS. On the way back, then, again listening in on port 9991 for subpools 1 and 2, or port 9993 for subpools 3 and 4, then I come back to the same IMS Connect. And then IMS Connect will look at the IMS plex it's in and find the IMS ID associated with this definition to go to the correct IMS system. And in this case, there's just one. Okay, so if I do an open, my example here then says that my ISC TCPIP definition for IMS, I would have to have two statements. One for, in the DFSD DC member of ProcLive, I would have to have a statement for KICS B1 node and KICS C1 node. And I would do, if I'm starting the sessions from IMS, then I would say open node KICS B1 user SP1 user SP2 and open node KICS C1 user SP3 user SP4. Okay. And just one more example. I kind of got carried away here. I thought this was kind of fun. So on page 102, I have three IMS systems and two CICS systems. So multiple IMSs and multiple CICSs that can be done. I'm not going to go through all the flows here, just to let you know that it can be done, and it's a question of specifying the definitions on either side of IMS as well as CICS, and then making sure you have everything matched up within IMS Connect. So this truly is a system programming task. Page 103, examples of session initiation from CICS as well as IMS. And in IMS, what I've given you examples to this point is for static terminals, where I did an open desk node and then a user and a username. You can also specify for dynamic terminals session initiation, in which case you would do an open node, the name of the node, and then the user would be the subpool name, and then a logon D, a logon descriptor name. And that logon D would be the descriptor that would have the local icon and the ISC TCPIP specification. So here's an example. Here's a few pictures. And I'm really going to really look at the dynamic ones because we've already seen what a static one would do. So the dynamic, which is on the upper half of the visual, if I say open node, kicks 1, user cap 1, logon D, LU6, TCP 1, remember these definitions don't exist in IMS. They're not statically defined. All we have is a logon descriptor. And my logon descriptor that I have ahead of time created says L for logon descriptor space LU6 TCP 1, which is my name, unit type equals ISC TCPIP, local icon, that's a keyword, and then local icon equals icon 1, and that's the name in the IMS plex for IMS Connect. So the way I would issue the command is open node, K1, KIX1 that will create the control block for the CICS, user CAC1 for the subpool, logon D, and then take the information out of the logon descriptor called LU6TCP1. We build the control blocks and send a request to IMS Connect. For a second session, I would do open node KIX1 user, maybe CAC2, logon D, LU6TCP1. And then everything else is the same as far as the definitions in IMS Connect, as well as in CICS, where you have to have the TCP/IP service specified, as well as an IPCon definition for each parallel session, or in our case, a subpool or user control block. Okay, so this is the example on page 104. A couple of things to remind you, reserve SOC and MAC SOC. Make sure your MAC SOC includes the number of reserve sockets that you've had, that you have. A couple of configuration definitions, page 106. Static ISP termination terminals are defined in the GEM, ISP TCP IP keyword, and the DFS DC member proc live. And everything else on this that we talk about for ETL login descriptors, the CSL environment has to be enabled, IMS Connect resources, and then CICS has to be also created to match the IMS definitions. So when you maintain VTAM and TCP/IP connections, page 107, just a suggestion, you just might want to create a new set of subpools for the TCP/IP support, and, you know, just as you're migrating. And we do have migration and fallback considerations, page 108. You can migrate statically defined IC terminals to TCP/IP. Just make sure you have the DFS DC member coded with ISC TCP/IP keyword, and then you have to cold start IMS. And we assume also CSL has been enabled with the SCI address space. If you want to fall back, then you have to delete the parameter out of the DFS DC member, and you have to cold start, okay? A warm start will still use a control blocks after the, you know, that were active at the time of a failure. So we would still use have the ISC TCP/IP definitions. Review the kicks and requirements. So cold start if you're using static terminals. ETL is a little bit different. It truly is far more dynamic. So for ETL on page 109, you would define the logon descriptors, make your definition changes to KIX, and then issue the command. Open desk node, the name of the node that matches KIX, user for your subpool, and logon D and the name of the logon descriptor. If you want to fall back, you would simply quiesce or stop the existing ISC connections and then cold start the subpools. And all that is you do a slash assign user and the name of the subpool to the VTEM pool. That's a session name. And then you can reissue the command with VTEM. Use open desk node user 1. Note that there's no logon descriptor defined here. So it would be a logon descriptor associated with the node as opposed to a specific logon descriptor that specifies TCP/IP. So everything, there's no requirement for a cold start if you're using ETO. Just to let you know, page 110, logon and sign-on exits are informed that ISC TCP/IP is used. Page 111, there are four new variables in the IOVP that will be defined in the IVP server configuration for the logon descriptor, for example, and an IMS Connect to help you in the IVP. As well as on page 112, job IVP E302J has been updated to add the config member, and then there are a set of new jobs for the IVP. And that brings us to the end. The balance of your handouts are an appendix. I just wanted to make sure that, like on page 114, if you look at that, that you can look at this documentation and know that we had some log record changes, there were some automated operations messages, as well as commands. But I decided that I would allow this, I would just give it to you to read on your own later. So, So I have 1 minute. I'm going to give this back to the operator just to see if there's any quick questions. If you're thinking about what I've talked about over the past several hours, then we have time at the end of the day that you can ask the questions or you can email us those specific questions. So I'm going to give it back to you, April.
Thank you. If you'd like to ask a question, simply press the star key followed by the digit 1 on your telephone keypad. Also, if you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Once again, press star 1 at this time. We'll pause for a moment. And you may also submit your questions via email to IBMIMS@us.ibm.com. Once again, IBMIMS@us.ibm.com, and it appears there are no phone questions at this time. Ms. Wendler?
Yes. So I guess what we can do is go to lunch.
Okay, great. I'll go ahead and place music back onto the conference, and we will resume at 12:30 Central Time, 1:30 Eastern Time. Good day, everyone, and welcome back to the System Enhancements Conference Call. Again, today's call is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Ken Blackman. Please go ahead.
Thank you. So hopefully you have page 1, IMS 13, System Enhancements. Let's go ahead and go to slide 2. This is the system topic. So what we're going to cover during this portion is some enhancements made to IMS Connect itself. As Susie pointed out this morning, IMS Connect is the TCP/IP listener, a runtime environment for IMS, and so we'll talk about some enhancements we made to that. We've also made some enhancements as far as commands. Each version of IMS, we do things to help integrate the IMS Connect with the base product, so we'll cover those in command enhancements. We'll talk about some enhancements to the repository. As you know, Version 12 introduced the IMS repository as a way for you to manage your dynamic resource definitions in a single position, single place. So we'll talk about some things we've done in 13 to enhance that capability. In the IMS user exit enhancements, we'll review this an SP that went out with version 12 to introduce the capability as far as managing user exits. And we'll talk about that SP, but we'll also cover information about 13, some additions we've made as far as those user exits. In the case of security, what we're talking about there is removal of security macro. As you know, each version of IMS, we're also moving towards things to get out of the sysgen process, definition process itself. So the security macro is another aspect of that that we're moving away from. The diagnostic command enhancements, what we're going to do here is review the new capabilities we've introduced with diagnostics. Most basically, this command is used when you work with IMS Level 2 and they want to work with you as far as resolving a problem. They'll give you information as far as when you use this command, here's specific control blocks they want you to snap out. So we'll talk about how those enhancements and made to that diagnostics area. In the area of concurrent application threads, we'll talk about this as far as what we're doing to provide increased number of runtime environments, dependent regions, if you will, that can support processing within IMS. And we'll also see tomorrow how those come into play regarding additional runtime environments we support when we're trying to do integration access to IMS itself. And then, once again, we'll kind of review some of the reductions of total cost of ownership. So let's move to slide 3. That's the IMS Connect enhancements. So let's go ahead to slide 4. So what we're going to cover in here is the XML converter enhancements. The XML converter routines, those work in conjunction with the IMS SOAP gateway. What we need to solve is if I'm going to be using SOAP protocols to access IMS transactions, I need a way to modify and massage the XML data stream to conform to the input-output message that your application program running IMS expects to get. So we have to have these converter routines that are managed by IMS Connect. So we'll talk about what we've done as far as giving you some query information, but also some things we've done as far as to increase the number of converter routines that we could load. Another aspect as far as managing the converter runtime environment is because we're using COBOL routines to do that conversion, we need to support the language environment. And one of the things we want to provide is if I do have problems, if one of my converter routines have bends, how can I restart and reset myself from an IMS Connect perspective without having to shut down IMS Connect. So prior to IMS 13, if you had problems, you had to shut IMS Connect down and restart it. Now you'll see that we have some auto restart capabilities within IMS Connect, so then we can keep IMS Connect up and running to support those add-ins. In the area of expanded recorder trace records, we'll talk about some things we've done now to give you more recorder trace information if you are diagnosing problems with working with TCP/IP clients who want to access your IMS system. Another enhancement we have is in the case of RACF event notification facility. In version 12, we introduced the capability for you to cache RACF user IDs. And one of the things we want to provide, though, is to leverage if I make a change, if my RACF system administrator makes a change, I need to be notified of that change so I can refresh my cache. So we'll see how in 13 we take advantage of RACF's event notification facility so we can, under the covers, automatically do that for you. Another thing we've done is when IMS Connect is servicing socket requests, when clients want to come in and get a socket and access your IMS transactions or data, we work with the ZOS communication server. The ZOS communication server has the capability of working with the utilizing the workload manager to determine where is the best place to send a connection request. So we'll see how what we've done with IMS Connect now, how we can report information to WLM that can then be used by the ZOS communication server to determine where is the best place to route a new connection request. So we'll see how that's done. In the area of TCP/IP backlog queue size, this is a pawn that's set up with your TCP/IP system programmer. But what we've done is we've done some additions in the case of IMS Connect where we can work in conjunction with that parameter definition and maybe increase the size of that backlog queue. So we'll see how that comes into play. And in the area of passphrase support, as you know, we've had the capability to support user ID password, and we also had the capability with IMS Connect to do user ID pass ticket. Now passphrases is the latest thing coming in as far as giving you capability to make it easier for the user to identify themselves in the system. So we'll see how we put into place the passphrase support capability with IMS Connect. And the resume TPIP socket termination, we'll kind of review that again. That's a capability that Susie mentioned this morning, how we can recover from resume TPIP where we have a wait forever status. And then finally, we'll kind of review some performance enhancements we've done with version 13. So going on now to slide 5. So what this is about here is, like I say, the converter routines that we use to support the IMS SOAP gateway function. What we've done now, we've increased the current limit. It used to be 100, so now at version 13, we can go up to 2,000 as the maximum number of converter routines. And what we've done is in the adapter statement in the configuration, we have a new parameter, max conversion. And so you can specify what's the maximum value you want to have, up to 2,000. You can also see that we've also retrofitted this back to version 12 via the APAR. So the other thing we've done is we take advantage of the type 2 commands, is we have a new query command for IMS Connect, and we specify type converter. And this way you can get additional information about your converter routines that are running inside of IMS Connect. Some of the things we'll show you is the current number of converter routines and what is that maximum limit you set based upon that max CVRT parameter. So hopefully with this will give you some enhances as far as flexibility using those converter routines when you work with IMS SOAP Gateway. So on to slide 6 then. This is kind of an example then of the query routine. You can see what I could do is I could do a specification for the type, which is converter. In this case, I've done a name all to show me all of those. And what you'll see in here, some of the things we've added is the time access, and so it's the last time that particular converter routine was accessed. And the time crate shows you when that converter routine was loaded by IMS Connect. So the first time request comes in and we need to use converter routine, that's when IMS Connect will load that. So we'll show you that time. And the other thing we have, we'll show for you then, is a use count. So how many times since I have loaded this and accessed, the last time I accessed, how many times have I been actually using this particular converter routine? So kind of gives you some better information as far as what routines do I have, are they being used anymore. So if I have a use count of zero and it's been a long time since I accessed that, that might be a candidate for reviewing that maybe you don't need that converter routine anymore. On slide 7, then, we show you that what we've also done is the existing commands we have. In the case of the write to operator view HWS command, what we've added to here now, you can see for the adapter, we also give you what's the maximum current count that you've defined, and then the actual number that we're using. So in this example here, we're showing we define a maximum of 400, and we're currently using 15. Also on the query type command for show adapter, we also have that information. We expanded that to give you information regarding the max current and also the number of current users of that converter routine. Going on to slide 8 then, so these commands are only accepted by version 12 and version 13 systems. Type 2 commands themselves, the command regarding the converters itself, the query those converters, that command is not supported by IMS Connect. We had to make a change to IMS Connect to support that new query capability. That change was not put into version 12. So if you try it, if you have a version 12 IMS Connect and the version 13 and you route that command to all of those, then the version 12 system won't be able to support that query command. You'll just get an error message back. Let's go to slide 9 now. And here we're getting into the auto restart of the language environment. Like I said, when we install these converter routines, they're generated by RDZ and they're COBOL routines. So we need to have LE environment because IMS Connect is written in assembler and C, so we have to have a way of managing multiple languages. So LE is what we use for that capability, and one of the things we could do is reinitialize the LE environment when we have a converter admin. So something can be going along and the converter will fail, and so what we want to do is recognize that, catch that, let you know that it's failed, but we don't want you to have to go through shutting down the IMS Connect and restart just to refresh the LE environment. So we will do that mechanism under the covers. And then when that converter routine is requested again, that's when we'll load that again. The other thing we'll do is we automatically refresh our BP user exit for the XML adapters. So when you configure IMS Connect to support the adapter's environment, one of the things you'll identify is this XML adapter routine. It's HWS XLM-A0. So in that definition, you set up admin limits. And when those then are reached, we will also automatically on the covers now refresh that user exit routine. Once again, to save you having to do a restart of IMS Connect. Going on to slide 10 then, here's an example of a BP display that kind of gives you the information about the XML adapter exit routine. So in this case we haven't had any admins yet, we haven't reached our admin limit count, and we've only had one call to it so far. Okay, so going on to slide number 11. One of the things that we have when we work with particularly testing new clients or testing new applications that want to access IMS Connect is you may need to activate the recorder trace to say, okay, what is it the client has sent in to me that IMS Connect receives and determine why can I not process my request to IMS for either transactions or databases. So what we've added now is the capability for you to specify want to capture the entire message being sent and received. So now we're going to give you everything. So all the data that's been sent from the client into IMS Connect, we will now give you that trace information. And likewise, once we send it into to IMS and get a response back, we're going to flow back, here's all the data that came back from IMS. So in order to do this, we do need to have the trace level set to high in external, and also use an external trace data set. So I have an example here of how you can use the update command to update the trace table that's being used, that's being managed by BPE to set the level high. And you also, what we also want you to do is go ahead and externalize that to external EQLGS. What that means is you'll set up a BP external trace data set. Since you're going to be increasing the volume of data that we're going to be recording, it makes sense to go ahead and write that out to an external data set as opposed to filling up the internal memory tables of IMS Connect itself. So also to point out is that this not only works for TCP/IP accessing IMS transactions, it also works for supporting those DRDA sockets. So when I have a client who wants to come in and access IMS databases through open database capability using DRDA protocols, we'll also trace that information. Susie mentioned that we now have ISC support, so we'll trap all the information. So we'll also show you then, in this case, you need to have OM, ODBM, MSC, and ISC communications. We'll support all those areas. In order to help you with this, then, we've updated our macro, the HWFUSTAT macro, what was an internal macro before 13, and now what we've done is we've converted that to a non-OCO macro. So what we'll give you now is a ship with IMS, and that's a macro you can now look at and see how we map out the records. So moving on to slide 12, you see there's actually two DSECs we have within this macro now. One was maps the original short record trace records. At that time, we only captured the first 100 bytes of an input-output message. And if you looked at that trace information, you would see we have an input buffer area and output buffer sections. So now we extended that with this new large records, large recorder of trace records. So now we have a DSEC macro that's going to contain, once again, the entire input message and also the entire output message that comes back. And we show you here, and I have an eye catch. It shows you fields you can look for to catch the information, such as call ID and then the contents of the particular message type. Based upon who's service that request? Is it ISC? Is it MSC? Is it ODBM? Is it OM? And the point of this is also you can see that when the message comes in to IMS Connect, so IMS Connect is doing the TCP/IP receive, we're going to record all information. And then we're going to send that over to XCF to get to OTMA, our SCI to get to ODBM. So we're going to record that information as we send it out of IMS Connect. And then when IMS responds back to IMS Connect, that's what we call the XCF receive, we're going to record that information again for you. And then finally, right before we send that data out to your client, the TCP/IP send, we'll do one more. So there's four occasions we're going to be tracing the entire record for you. That's why we also recommend writing this out to an external trace data set. So on slide 13, then you'll see that in order to take advantage of this capability, you do need to set the trace level to high in your recorded trace. Say it could have a warning, this could have a significant amount of trace records. We would expect that probably where you'll be doing this mostly is in your initial testing environments when you're trying out new capabilities. Like I have a new open database client and I want to test out and see if I'm getting the correct data in and getting the correct data response back from my IMS databases. Very rarely I would expect you to have to use this in production environment, but if you need to, the capability is there. Alright, so moving to slide 14 then, what we have here is the capability for RACF to notify IMS Connect that we've had a change to a particular user ID. like say back in version 12 days, we entered the we provided you the capability where you could cache those RACAP user IDs. And so what happened is when a user ID password came into IMS Connect, we would make the, and you have RACAP turned on, we would make the SAF call to authenticate that user. When we got that back, we'd have the ACE control block, and we would cache, we could cache that now inside of IMS Connect. So a subsequent request that comes in for that same user with the same password, we could check and say, okay, I've already authenticated this guy. He's in my cache. I don't need to make another call to the SAP interface. I'll just use what I have right here within my cache environment. So that's all great and it's fantastic. But however, what happens is if my security administrator needs to make a change, maybe yes, maybe the password is expired. So we go through and make that change. So either a connect or remove or an all user command is put in play. We actually need to revoke the user itself. When that happens, then IMS Connect needs to know that, and so we could take an action as far as clean up our cache. So we take advantage of RACAP's event notification facility. So what will happen then is RACAP will notify us there's been a change. We'll go through our cache. We'll find that ACE for that user, and then we can remove that guy, that user from the cache. That way then we have we can clean up, and now we can refresh that as far as getting new information for that particular user ID. This way, you don't have to go through and do a manual integration. Before this, you would have to do a command to IMS Connect after you did the RACAP command to tell IMS Connect to refresh his cache. On slide 15 now, what we're going to get into is the capability where IMS Connect now as a server can report its health to WMM, the workload manager. So how we do this is we take advantage of what you set up in the ZOS communications server, in this case, the Sysplex distributor. The Sysplex distributor provides the capability to when he receives a request from a TCP IP client, and it's for a port that's been defined to IMS Connect, he could determine where do I need to go. Prior to server workload manager method, what we had in place was either round robin or a base WN environment. Round robin, all we would do is every time I got a new request comes in, he would go through and say, did I go to IMS Connect A? Yeah, well, let's go to IMS Connect B. In the case of base WM, if I'm getting information about particular LPAR where I'm running my IMS Connect and that LPAR itself may not be able to provide the service I need, doesn't have the CPU capacity, then he could choose to route to a different IMS Connect using that same port number. So what's been taking place now is now we have the capability with server WLM where IMS Connect itself, we could give information to workload manager and then the Sysplex distributor could get that information and determine, okay, which of my IMS Connects do I want to go to. Another thing that's been added is you'll see here I have System 1 and System 2. On System 1, I have two IMS Connects, 1 and 2, and they're sharing port number 9999. So in this case, what I need to do is in my definition for that port that's assigning that port number to IMS Connect, I also need to identify that I want to use shared port WLM. This way, I could have my two IMS Connect instances in the same LPAR share that same port number. And then you'll see on IMS System 2, I have another IMS Connect, but I'm also using port number 9999. So the combination of these allows Sysplex distributor to be aware of all the different IMS Connects. In this case, they're supporting 999, and they're available in my System 1 and System 2. So let's move forward now as far as the background and see what we're going to be doing with this. So on slide 16, what we've added to IMS Connect now is he will report his health. So the initial value is 100. And essentially what we do, it's based on the max SOC value. So inside of IMS Connect, when you specify max SOC, if you don't specify a value, the default is 50. But that's the algorithm, that's the information we use in order to report to WM and says, here's our help as far as managing these socket connections that are coming into IMS Connect. So the way it works then is we will notify with WLM if we have an increase or decrease in our health by 5%. And then what we do is based upon that value, we're going to do a multiple of 5 to move into that new value, either increasing or decreasing. So we have an example here is if I have a value, if I'm currently at 80% healthy, then I could actually have a range of 76% to 84%. But 80% is what we're showing for health. So my decreasing example here, let's say I report I'm 80%, and then I've had a reduction in as far as my health by 10%. So we're saying, well, since 10% is greater than 5%, then I can reduce my value to 70%. So I've done that, and now as I'm continuing to go along, I have another reduction. This time it's only 6%. But however, since that's still greater than my 5% margin, I will still report that change. But instead of having a value, the value is going to be 65%, not 64%, because we're going to do the multiple of 5. So it kind of gives you an idea of how, as we're flowing along with an IMS Connect, we're monitoring our socket connections, how we can report back then, and when to report back to WM as far as our capability to serve a socket request. So moving on to slide 17 then, how this works is WM itself is going to assign a weight range from 1 to 64. And then based upon that, he'll adjust his workload if we're not meeting those goals. And that's across, you know, all those systems. Like I showed you earlier, I had System 1 and System 2. So he adjusts them based upon our capabilities for all across the whole system. So in this case here, I have, let's say if I have each system, I'm at 100%. So if I have a single IMS Connect on a single system, he starts up, he's at 100%. If I have multiple IMS Connects and they're sharing that port, each will be 100%. But both for that system are still equal to 100%. Because what takes place is we look at the system. So even though I have two IMS Connects on the same one, they're providing 100% for the entire system. The other thing we'll point out is this is a function that we've added in IMS Connect 13. It's not in previous versions of IMS Connect. So in the case of version 12 IMS Connect, this information would not be reported back to WLM. All right, so just like Susie had earlier, we like to have pictures. So on slide 18, we're going to give an example. In this case, this is a single system. However, I have two IMS Connects. So in this case, on example one side, you can see I have IMS 1 and IMS Connect 2. Both of those are at 100% healthy. And so when a request comes in, we have out of 64 Connects requests, 2 are going to be sent to IMS Connect 1, 32 will be sent to IMS Connect 2. And the format we go through, I get 64 Connects requests. I have two IMS Connects running that system, so I divide that by 2, so that gives me 32 connection requests. And fortunately right now, for each one of those connection requests, those 32 for both IMSs, I'm running 100%, so they got out of them both. Now let's move to example 2, and you can see, now I have a reduction in my IMS Connect 1. So HWS1, his health now has dropped down to 50%. So once again, out of my 64 connection requests, now, this time, I'm only going to send 16 to IMS Connect 1, and I'll send 48 to IMS Connect 2 to support those 64 connections. And once again, how do we get to that? Well, we still take our 64 requests. I still have two IMS Connects, so I'm going to split that, so it's still 32 per IMS Connect. However, now, when I run through the calculation, I see, okay, when I take 32 connection requests times 50, that only gives me 16, so I can only send 16 to IMS Connect 1. So now the balance, the balance of 48, I will now route to IMS Connect 2. So that kind of gives you an idea how we could take the information, report back to WM, and we could use that then to distribute how I'm going to send those socket connection requests. And I'll point out again that this case, right, both IMS Connect 1 and IMS Connect 2 are listed on port 9999, so that means that they're able to service the same IMS application runtime environments. Moving on to slide 19 then, we're going to make it a little bit more complicated for you. So in this case, I still have my System 1, and I still have my IMS Connect 1 and my IMS Connect 2, but I've added now a System 2. In this case, I've now added my IMS Connect 3. All three of my IMS Connects are listing on port number 9999. And so, in this case, on example 1, you can see we're going to start out. Everybody's healthy. Came up, so 1, 2, and 3 are all 100% healthy. And once again, I still use my 64 connection request as the basis to distribute my work. So in this case, I'm going to send 32 to System 1 with two IMS Connects. I'm going to send 32 to System 2 with one IMS Connect. So you can see we're splitting now. We still got the same 64 connection request, but we're splitting by system. So in this case, since I have my 64 requests coming across, I got to split those across those two systems. That's where I get my 32 connections per system. Well, System 1's got 32, System 2's got 32. Now when I break it down as far as System 1, I say, okay, I got my 32 connection requests coming in. I have two IMS Connects. So since both of those are running at 100%, I'm going to split those. So 16 is going to go to IMS Connect 1, 16 are going to go to IMS Connect 2. And over on System 2 side, then, I've got all 32 connection requests coming in to that one IMS Connect. So 100%, all 32 are going to go to IMS Connect 3. You can see now what we've done, utilizing SysFlex Distributor, now we're spreading the workload across the two systems and across three IMS Connects. Now when I get into my reduction of capabilities, in this case, you can see I've reduced IMS Connect 1 and IMS Connect 2 by 50%. And IMS Connect 3 is still running at 100%. So once again, I go through my 64 connection request. What we're going to show this time, though, is 16 is going to be sent to System 1, and the remaining is going to go to System 2. And how we went through that? Well, I take my 64 requests, just like I did before, divide those by the two systems. That gives me 62 per system. However, in this case, the 32 connections are going to the two IMS Connects. 16 are going to go to 1, 16 go to 2. However, when I take that 16 request and multiply it by the 50%, I have to have a reduction, so now I can only do 8 to IMS 1 and 8 to IMS Connect 2. So that gives me a total of 16. So to do the balancing then, and since IMS Connect 3 is running on System 2 at 100%, he can handle the other 48. So I had to reduce the number of stocking connections I can give to 1 and 2 of IMS Connect, but IMS Connect 3 is able to pick up that additional workload. So this is the what's taking place under the covers between IMS Connect reporting to WLM, his capabilities as far as servicing socket requests, and WLM and SysFlex Distributor working together to balance that work distribution across the systems. On slide 20, then, what we have here is show you the different display commands that are available. And what I have is I have examples of output coming, one where it's set up to do distribution method of server WLM. I show you one where up in the right-hand corner where it's based WLM processing, and finally round robin. So those are the three types of ways we can set up with the SysFlex Distributor to route work across the different IMS Connects. Going to slide 21. Another thing we need to work with is what we call the backlog queue size. And now this comes into play in the background is when a socket request comes into the communication server, he has to determine what support number. So we've been using 9999 for this IMS Connect. It's okay. It's a 999 request. I'm going to route that to that client. Now, if IMS Connect, he's listening and he gets that request, there are things he needs to go through as far as setting up to make that an active socket connection. So as he's doing that processing, if I have more requests coming in from the socket request, IMS Connect may not be able to get to the process of accepting that new socket connection. What TCP/IP provides on the communication server stack is a thing called SOM max con value, and that's defined in TCP/IP, and that specifies the queue length. How many can I have queued up waiting for IMS Connect to respond to my request to activate that socket connection. The default value is 10. This is a value that's going to be set by your TCP/IP system programmer. So what we've done now is in IMS Connect itself, what you can do is you can configure IMS Connect to say with this DuPont TCP/IP queue, what I'd like to do is override when IMS Connect initializes. You'd like to notify TCP/IP that I want to override that connection request. So let's say my SOM-MOX connection request has been specified as 200 by TCP/IP, and you specify a TCP/IP queue value in IMS Connect of 100. So what we'll do is we'll contact TCP/IP and say, I would like to have a backlog queue of 100. Well, since 100 is less than the SOM-MOX connection value of 200, he'll honor that. And so we'll have a backup queue now of 100. That's the purpose of this queue capability. So here's an example. It's on page 22, then, which you can specify. The default value is 50, and the maximum value is 2,147,483,647. Now, I've done some research. That is a prime number. And also, that is a 32-bit signed integer max value. So we're giving you the maximum number, maximum value you can specify, a 32-bit signed integer number. When IMS Connect is initializing, he'll look at this value specify. If you have a value between 0 and 49, he'll set that to 50. If you exceed the 2 billion number, then we'll get an error message saying you can't do that. Okay, passphrase support on slide 23. We talked about this earlier. What we want to be able to do now is give you the capability to, instead of using an 8-character passphrase, a password coming with up to 100 characters for a passphrase itself. We've also provided this in conjunction with the IMS Team Resource Adapter. So we'll talk about that later on. I just want to let you know that we do have in play, we've made changes to IMS Connect to support the passphrase capability. All right, on slide 24, we've talked about this before. This is the socket enhancement for resume T-pipe, where I have a client who says, I want to do a resume T-pipe, I want to wait forever. And as soon as the message gets put onto that T-pipe queue, IMS Connect will notify me, and I'll be able to retrieve that message. So this is what we call resume type auto or a single wait. We're just waiting for response. So what I can recognize now through this process is that remote client session is terminated. And what we can do then is we know then how to break that off so we no longer have to wait for messages from IMS in order to put that onto that T-pipe queue. On slide 25, then, there are some performance enhancements. One of the things we've done now, we've changed how we obtain storage when we need it to send messages to XCF services. So we're going to use a cPool now instead of a storage obtain. This does improve our performance. However, it does add 167 megabytes of extended private to the IMS Connect address space. So when we do this, one of the things you may need to look at is what is the size, the region size of my IMS Connect. And if I've got the IFF USI exit routine in play, that's going to control or dictate what's the maximum size of storage I can allow for an address space. Some other enhancements we've done is zip enablement. So what IMS Connect will do now will honor when we're doing DRDA threads, our SOAP gateway threads, or for processing NFC, TCP/IP through IMS Connect, or ISIC. What we'll try to do is while we're doing our processing, we'll set up IMS Connect to be enabled to do support for ZIPs, and we'll run as much as we can on a ZIP processor. The summary then. What we've covered is the XML converter routines. Hopefully now you'll see if you're using SOAP gateway. We're going to make it more flexible for you as far as utilizing those converter routines and manager routines. We've seen how auto restart with the language environment now, how we can eliminate IMS Connect restarts. I can keep your IMS Connect up longer to support your SOAP Gateway runtime environments. We've seen how we've expanded the recorded trace records now to give us more information regarding input coming in to IMS through IMS Connect and responses coming back to track and see if I'm having some type of errors processing. Big thing regarding event notification facility now, so IMS Connect can be notified that I have made a change to that specific user ID. The key with that is now it avoids manual intervention in this environment. And then finally on page 28, we talked about, went through what it is reporting our overall health to WLM, so hopefully this will make your IMS Connect and your communication server smarter as far as how to distribute socket connections across your environment. We saw how the TCP/IP backlog size, now IMS Connect can have an impact on what he wants to set up as far as utilizing that backlog queue size. Saw how passphrase support now, we'll get into more detail later on getting the security, we'll see, but we do know that at least now passphrases can be flow in up to 100 bytes of a passphrase. We saw how with the socket termination now we can release those listening sockets waiting for a reply from the data store. Actually, we covered those performance happens with the zip processing. So we're about 5 minutes ahead of our break time, I think. So we can go ahead and start the break now if you want. And then we'll resume with System Enhancements Part 2 at 2:30. Is that correct?
Yes, thank you, sir. We can start our break now, and we will resume in 15 minutes. Once again, please stand by. And welcome back to the System Enhancements Conference Call. Again, the call is being recorded. Ken Blackman, you may proceed.
Okay, we're going to continue now with the system enhancement. We're going to be on part two. So the slide you should have is IMS Connect Command Enhancements. So going to the next slide, what we're going to talk about is some new dynamic capabilities. What you can do now with IMS Connect through command processing now and using our new Type 2 commands, we can add new port definitions and new data store connections. And by doing this, then you don't have to restart your IMS Connect. So this should provide, once again, greater availability as far as your IMS Connect environment. We're trying to minimize outages, not only with IMS, but also with IMS Connect. So moving to the next slide, what you need for prerequisites. We need to add the structured call interface, the SCI. That's what is used to route the commands to IMS Connect. And OM Operations Manager is a capability that would use to build a command and send a command through SCI to IMS Connect. The hardware requirements are going to be the same as IMS 13. So moving to the next slide then, here's an example of that Type 2 command. What I'm doing is I'm going to do a create IMS Connect, in this case type port. And we have the name parameter that specifies the port number. If you have an existing port that's already defined, you can say like and use that as a model. That's an optional capability. And you can also then set different types of attributes, optional attributes. In the port type, you identify, is it a regular port that's going to be used to access IMS OTMA, or is it a DRDA port that's going to be used to access IMS databases through ODBM. Pretty much the information that you would define today in your HWS configuration file for regular ports or for DRDA ports is what we're going to give you through the command process. So going to the next slide then, here's the examples of setting the attributes. So I can set up a keep alive value for TCP/IP. If I want to use an edit routine on a regular port, you can define that edit routine. And if I want to set up port timeouts for my DRDA port, I could also do those. So on the next slide, then, I have some examples of the create command and their equivalents as far as their port definitions themselves within the proc line member. So you can see I have a type 2 command for regular port where I create that port. In this case, it's port number 8888. I also have an example then of a DRDA port where so the port type is DRDA, and I'm set up port 7777. Going on to the next slide, Dan, an example of the output. So when you go through the command input, you're going to create this command, right? OM is going to route this command through SCI and get it over to IMS Connect. IMS Connect is going to receive that command. And when IMS Connect gets the command, OM is going to know that the command was successfully sent. What we don't know, because it's asynchronous in the case of IMS Connect processing, is did the command work? So after IMS Connect parses and uses that create command, and he's going to create that command, he'll show you then an AWS message that says, I'm now listening to that port. So there's two things you need to be aware of. Now, one, I was able to successfully send the command, and two, IMS Connect was able to build that port and is now listening on that port. Same with the data store. Here's a laid out for a data store definition. Once again, I can identify what's the data store name. I can also use the like attribute if I have an existing data store I want to map to, and also I can set those values. So the same information I have today in my AWS config file, I now can use through a create command. Slide 9, this kind of breaks down and shows you all the different attributes that are available to you, how you can set those in when you're defining this data store connection. And then on slide 10, moving to the next slide, create IMS Connect data store name. You can see some additional values as far as setting those attributes. Going to the next slide, I have an example then of a create IMS Connect type data store. Shows you the new type 2 command, and also then shows you equivalent configuration statement definitions with that. So it just gives you a way down to use a command to define these capabilities. And just like I mentioned before on the next slide here, the example of the output, I show you then how we've done a connect for a data store. Once again, OM is going to route that command request to IMS Connect. IMS Connect has to process that. OM is going to know he set the command okay. You have to see the AWS message comes out by IMS Connect to let you know that we've successfully processed that and we now have a connection to that data store. Some things to consider is these commands do not persist across an IMS Connect restart. IMS Connect does not have a log, so we don't have any way to track that information. So when you do those commands, if you don't care, if you want to shut down IMS Connect later on and bring it back up again, those port definitions or data store definitions would be gone. However, if you need to make those changes permanent, then what you need to do is after you've done these create commands, you need to go into the AWS config file and make those definition changes in that configuration. So the next time IMS Connect restarts, he'll pick up those changes. Next slide, some security considerations. Since we're coming through OM, OM supports the RACF opera commands class, so this would be the mechanism you'd use to set up and restrict who is authorized to use this create command. Next slide, benefits. Main thing is now you can add new ports and new data store connections to IMS Connect without having to restart your IMS Connect. So this should improve your IMS Connect availability, and we're leveraging, like say, the Type 2 command architecture. So we came out with Type 2 commands way back in version 8 days, so you can continue to see, as we evolve with IMS, we're going to continue to enhance those Type 2 command environments. All right, so now next slide we're moving into is IMS repository enhancements. Quick review, version 12 of IMS is where we introduced the repository capability. It was used to replace the resource definition data sets. Those were involved with dynamic resource definition. So as you dynamically defined new resources, applications, databases, transactions, or routing codes, we would capture that information. So now the idea behind a repository is to have one single place to manage those definitions across the IMS Plex for all IMS systems. So next slide is the highlights of this. So what we've done now is runtime definition changes can now be applied to an IMS when it warm starts or emergency restarts. So we have a change now to the import command. We specify scope all, and that way it'll provide to all IMS active and inactive systems. So I have an active IMS. When you restart it, it'll pick those changes up. Hopefully what this will see when this is makes it easier for you as far as managing your definition changes through DRD and manage your IMS Plex environment. So next slide then is some additional things we've done is in a system definition is sample JCL procedures for the repositories. So we came out in version 12. We gave you some initial jobs. We've done now is we've updated those and improved those, so hopefully this series of jobs that we list here on the slide will make it easier for you as far as either setting up a repository and start using the repository as you move to dynamic resource definition. The next slide then is an example of our import command with scope. So what we've done here is with the scope now, I can specify scope all. So that's going to apply to all the import command, to all the IMSs that are in IMS Plex. This is a default that's recommended. We're going to route that command to all IMS systems. A little footnote here. So if you have a routing list set up, if you're using the SPOC, what you want to do in this case, when you say scope all, you also want to do a route all. You want to make sure all your IMS systems in an IMS Plex receive this command. And then moving forward then, what will happen is when I do this, any inactive systems that have resources that are defined at a repository, we're going to create an IMS change list. And that will contain those resource names that have to be re-imported when that IMS comes, when that IMS restarts again. So it's read during a emergency restart or warm start processing. That way we can keep that system in sync then with your other IMS systems that are part of the IMS Plex who are sharing those resource definitions. So on the next slide then, I have an example here where I've done import definition. I've wrapped that to OM. OM is going to wrap that to all the IMSs that are part of the IMS Plex. So in this case, you can see IMS-1, that control region is up and active, but IMS-2 was not running at the time that command was routed. So he's been shut down either through an admin or just a normal shutdown process. So what will happen then is when that IMS-2 goes through restart processing, either NRE or ERE, we're going to automatically get then from the repository the change list for that IMS-2 system. So he'll be able to process information, update then his information he has as far as those different resources, so now he'll be in sync with everybody else when that import command was first issued. Next slide then is it says the key thing is that with all those definitions will be part of the IMS Plex whether I'm active or inactive. Like I said, that was our default. We expect you to use that to help you as far as keeping your IMS Plex consistent with all those resource definitions. The next slide, message is issued. So what we'll do is if there is a change list, we're going to process that change list, and during that we'll come out with some DFS messages that will let you know that we've started the process of doing the change list, and we'll identify those resources that have been successfully processed. Then we're finished, and we'll give you a message that we're done. We successfully processed that change list. On the next slide, then, is if I have some type of error. So we'll put out an error message and let you know, inform you that we could not successfully do the process of that change list. We had some errors you had to deal with. On the next slide, this kind of what's in the repository, it says it's the stored resource definitions, programs, transactions, databases, and those fast routing codes. The change, like I said, that's new. And so the import scope all is what you want to use as far as picking those changes in so we have synchronization. The other thing you could do then on the next slide is you could have a scope of all, but you could also have a scope of active. This would be the same as what you had in version 12. In this case, then, if you say scope equals active, only those systems that are active at the time the import command was routed will be able to process the import of the resource definitions. So any systems that are down will not have a change list created, and they will not be synchronized. So you'd have to go through a manual import. So on the next slide, then, I have an example here where what I've done is I've done the initial import. I'm saying scope is active. I route that to all of my IMS systems. In this case, IMS2, he's not available. However, since it was active, we're not going to build a change list for IMS2. So when IMS2 goes through normal restart processing or merger restart processing, no change list is going to be brought in. You'd have to go and do another import definition and route that then to IMS2 so that he can then pick up those changes. That's the difference between scope of all versus scope of active. And this just gives you some more information regarding the definition of a scope active. Now those do apply. On the final slide I have, migration considerations. You need to account for the fact that now you're going to apply this to inactive IMS systems. When you do scope equals all, so that change list will be created for them. There is an APAR, PP77568, that has some change list enhancements. There's a version 12 coexistence APAR you have to have, so if I do have IMS version 12 and IMS 13 and they're sharing the repository, you need to have APAR applied to be coexistent with 13. So the summary slide then is we think that this will be a much better way for you to manage your IMS systems, either inactive by having a scope all. We have a consistency as far as your system definitions for those different resources within your IMS Plex. Next section we're going to cover is user exit routines. So back in version 12, we provided, so on the next slide here, sorry I mentioned that. On the next slide here, I show you that we had an SPE, PM56010, and what that provided was a capability for us to refresh user exit routines. And here's the different exit routine types that were available. One of the things we're trying to do, we've mentioned this before, of all these dynamic definitions, user exit routines, we want to have the capability where when I bring up an IMS, runtime environment, and I have exit routines in play, I could dynamically refresh those, bring those in without having to shut down my IMS system. Keep your IMS system going 24/7. That's our goal. So what we did is we had a new refresh user exit type definition set up. We have a section in our DFS proc wide member where I can identify these user exit routines that could be then candidates for being refreshable. Next slide then, regarding this exit, what we do is we have exit types. Each exit type is independent. I could have multiple exit types specified. And if I do a refresh and one of those exit types fail, then I'm still able to process other exit types I have defined. So what you need to do is if I want to add or delete the user exit routine, I need to update the DFS DF proclive member and then issue the refresh user exit command. On the next slide, then, I have an example of this refresh command. We show you in here the exit routines that I have identified in my proclive member. Point out here that we have two routines. In this case, we're a separate error example where I have two modules, DFS CSTX2 and DFS ITRX3. One of those is for events. And so what I've shown you here is they're not in the load library. So on the next slide, then, what you'll see is once I've issued the command, refresh user exits, and I give you the different types I'll refresh, two types. STVE and init term, those failed because those load modules weren't in the library. So I got back a condition code of 92. But notice that the other exit types and their routine, those module names, I was able to process those, so they got refreshed. So on the next slide there, what I show you is that as you get back that response, error code 92, you can hit PF4 to see the log, to give you information, additional information about the failure of that request. And then on the next slide, when you go further down with the PF8, we'll identify you, here's what happened. We tried to bring in that user X routine, and the reason it failed is we had a build L error. But then I know I could take the action and say, okay, it didn't show up. I didn't show up because I didn't have my load library. Moving on to the next slide then, what we want to do with 13 is to add. So we're going to build upon that SP that's put in 12, and we also then want to build upon that with some additional extra routines. Expand that flexibility. So on the next slide then, I have for you a list of additional user exit services and more exit types that now we do provide. So the point is, as we move forward with it, with newer versions of IMS, you'll see us then continue to add to this list until we finally get all the exit types we support as part of this enhanced user exit services. Next slide, like I say, continue to use the refresh user routine to bring those new copies in. Use the query exit to display exit information. So we updated that. Considerations on the next slide. One of the things that could happen is when I bring in a new instance and I have an existing instance in play, it's still being used. There could be a static work area that could be sharing, it could be using that. So there's a flag that we have identified, and the new extra routine, when it comes in, just needs to check that flag to make for sure, okay, the previous extra routine that I'm refreshing has gone now, it's been removed, and so I now have full use of that static work area. Another point we have here is if you're going to be removing the RAS security extra routine, when you issue that refresh command, you also need to update your DFSPB proc line member to indicate that I'm changing my ISIS parameter where I don't want to use the RAS security extra routine anymore. So we won't call that anymore. Next slide, migration consideration. Like, so you need to update the DFS proc line member with that user exit definitions for those new exit types. Make sure you issue that refresh user exit command, say for adding and deleting those. You can also have a single user exit type migrated to using new services while other exit types can continue to be with non-enhanced services. So you could piecemeal this as far as once I go through and list my extra routines for a particular exit type, when I have those migrated, now I'll choose the next series of exit types. So you can pick and choose how you'd like to migrate your existing user exit routines that are supported for this enhanced environment. Next slide regarding security considerations. Once again, OM is going to be the one who's going to route the command in. He's going to rely upon the RACF opera commands class to restrict access. So this would be an example of how you would specify that IMS command and the resource name to RACF. So summary, we think, once again, as we move forward with these user exit services, we'll continue to provide ways for you to dynamically refresh your IMS environment, these exit routines, and continue to support multiple exit types from the single point of control. Next slide is on the security macro. Mentioned this earlier this morning. What we want to do is continue to get rid of the IMS stage one, stage two SysGen process, make IMS more dynamic. So on the next slide regarding the highlights, what we're going to be doing now is removing from your SysGen process the security macro. Part of that security macro has security extra routines that were part of the IMS nucleus. So the sign-offs, sign-on, sign-off security expert team, the transaction authorization expert team, and the security verification expert team. Those routines were linked in and part of the IMS nucleus. So one of the things we're going to be doing is if you have those extra teams, they're going to come out of the IMS nucleus and they're going to become independent modules. So we'll discuss what we need to do as far as how to handle that situation. So on the next slide, the benefits are, you know, that's one more thing we're removing to reduce what the system program has to deal with from security macro definitions. And the other part is freeing up the IMS nucleus, getting those user extra teams out of the IMS nucleus and making those independent load modules that you can work with. Next slide then, part of that startup is we have to take the R-class parameter, add that now to DFS-PB proc line member to identify what is the resource classes that's going to be supported by your IMS. The security count parameter has been added to the DFS-DC proc line member. The changes that we're making to the PB and DC proc line members, they're going to be supported by the IMS syntax checker. The other thing we've done is we have some main powers. You can retrofit the back to version 11 and version 12 to help as far as this migration to where I don't have the security parameters anymore. So it allows me to start setting up my proclite definitions to specify those R classes in the PB and DC proclite member as I prepare to migrate to version 13. On the next slide, though, if you do decide to leave the security macro in your stage 1 gen process, what you'll get back is return code 2 and give you an M note that says that security macro is not supported anymore and it's just going to be ignored when we go through IMS generation. The next slide then is the user exits removed from the nucleus. So like I mentioned before, these extra teams, they used to be bound as one within the IMS nucleus. Now they're going to be bound separately and loaded from a step line into 31-bit storage. We also provide a new 19.37i message to indicate those extra routines have been loaded. What we've also done is the sign-on extra routine is going to be called during IMS initialization. And so if you do have these user extra teams and you need to pull these apart, if you have a work area that you want to share between those three extra routines, the sign-on routine will get called first. You can get that storage, and then that area can be passed through the new CTS, ECP, and CTRN parameters. This replaces the old method of using V-type addressing as a way to share storage. It's something you got to look at because they're going to be separate modules now. Next slide, operational considerations then. You could have automation check for the 19.37i message to determine whether the X has been loaded or not. You need to change those X routines, though, to handle 31-bit mode and also to use a new parameter to share that storage. Migration considerations on the next page. Say apply the SPs to 11 or 12 so you can not support the new startup proc life member information. That way, when I have defined security macro, I can now move out of that and specify that in the proc lives. But the big thing is if you do use these extra routines is getting ready to remove those and change those to support being independent load modules. And also you want to remove the macro, the stage 1 macro, before you go to IMS 13. Another consideration for the next slide regarding migration, like I say, these are all bound. These three extra routines now are separate. You might, say, use a parameters to pass the extra routine. You can, if you choose to, if you don't want to use a common work area, you can create the CSECs, and you can link those as an alias and use it that way. That's another possibility if you choose to do that. We also recommend, just in case, you migrate to 13, and then you have to do a fallback that you might want to keep your original version of those routines until you've successfully completed your migration. You're not going to fall back anymore. This next slide, then, here's an example of JCL that you can use to set up then the entry and then the alias names to make that a composite module. So the next slide, the benefits, like I said, we're getting rid of the security macro, we're eventually getting rid of the sysgen process, we're getting those X routines out of the IMS nucleus now, they're going to be independent modules to work with, so hopefully it makes it easier to use as far as maintaining those modules for processing. Next slide I have then is RACA pass word phrase support. This is introduced with version 12 SBE. So on the next slide, like I say, we have passphrases now. You can also use those with the IMS TM Resource Adapter. The IMS TM Resource Adapter is a TCP/IP client who knows how to talk to IMS Connect. So it also knows how to handle passphrases that will be sent to RACF. Passphrases, they're going to be anything that's greater than 9 characters and up to 100 bytes is considered a passphrase. They could be mixed characters, mixed case letters, numbers, and special characters. Theory is they're going to be easier to remember than an 8-character password. So on the next slide here, I have examples of enhancements of TM Resource Adapter and IMS Connect. So like I said, the IMS TM Resource Adapter is now he'll build the capability of passing not only a password, but also this passphrase. And then IMS Connect will recognize that based upon the header information. So IMS Connect, as a TCP/IP server, has defined an IRM header area. And it also has an OTMA header area in order to talk to OTMA for processing. So TMRA, when he builds his message to send in, will have the information he needs to supply to IMS Connect regarding the message, but also the passphrase. So on the next slide, what I have for you here is an example of that breakdown. So the LLLL tells IMS Connect, here's the length of the entire message I'm going to receive. Then within the IRM header now, we've added the LLZZ and a splat phrase and then the passphrase. So that way, IMS Connect knows, okay, I have a passphrase coming, and I also know the length of that passphrase. And after that, it's business as usual as far as the OTMA header information and then LZZ transcode data. So this is how IMS Connect will recognize, oh, I'm getting a passphrase as opposed to a password now from the TM Resource Adapter. So going to the next slide, one of the things we need to be able to deal with is changing a passphrase. We currently have the capability within TM Resource Adapter to change passwords. So we just now, with the passphrase support, we're going to also expand that to say, all right, now I can pass in a passphrase. I can have an old passphrase, and I can change that to a new passphrase. So what I would do in this slide is say I'm going to invoke the exit routine within IMS Connect that handles password to passphrase changes. I would flow in my old passphrase, and then I have my new passphrase, and just like changing that, I have to have give it to you twice. Here's a new passphrase I want to fuse. Here it is again to make sure I have I'm consistent with what my new passphrase needs to be. So on the next slide, then, not only have we enhanced IMS Connect, we've also enhanced IMS. So MFS panels, we now have giving you some sample passphrase support panels, so anything greater than 8 bytes now will handle those as a passphrase. So on the next slide now, on this slide here, I'm talking about enhancements to existing functions, and I have a slash sign command where I pass in a WACA password phrase support. Now, I have an example of a slash sign where I think on your handouts you have ONP and you have a slash sign ONQ. Those two have now changed. There's been a change to our documentation. Those have been now replaced. So On your handouts, you want to say slash sign passphrase to replace ONP and slash sign passphrase Q to replace ONQ. So that's an update. So if you go to the IMS 13 Knowledge Center, you would also see those changes there. But these are used now for signing in to say, I want to give you a passphrase. If I use sign passphrase, I have to give you 100 bytes. That's required. It has to be within the MFS panel. We'll make for sure of that. IMS will remove any leading and trailing blanks. If the it's less than 9 bytes, then that's going to be considered a password. If I choose to use passphrase Q, then what I'm doing is I'm allowing me to put in quotes. And in this case, we're going to not remove leading blanks, and it doesn't have to be 100 bytes. It could be less than that because we're going to take what's in the quotes. So when changing password phrases, you must specify another password phrase, and it's the same for passwords. Only you're changing something that's going to be greater than 8 bytes. Also, the VTAM logon user data, if you want to use that and pass a passphrase in, you can now add that to the logon Apple ID. There's an example of that in the bottom of the slide. Next slide, then. User exit routines, so greeting message, the sign-on security exit, the logon user exit routines. If you're using those exit routines, you may want to change those to be able to handle now passphrases. Next slide, some usage considerations. Like I say, both passwords and passphrases are going to be supported by IMS. We recommend for MTL, write to operator, and TCL input that you go ahead and just continue use passwords instead of passphrases due to limited space. Next slide, migration considerations. We provided a APAR with on version 12 to help out with the migration effort. You can see that we also have then with IMS Connect, we have APARs you need that support this function. They can be applied independently to TMRA and IMS Connect. But they have to both be in place in order for you to use the passphrase feature. So summary, we now give you support for password phrases. Through TMRA, through IMS Connect, through the IMS sign-on command, and through VTAM logon user data. Next slide, the diagnose command enhancements. I talked about this earlier. The diagnose command is a way for IMS Level 2 to work with you as far as collecting diagnostic information. What we've added now is a sysout option. So now you can specify then when I do the snap, I want this to go to a sysout. Queue. By doing that then, it makes it easier for you to accumulate the information. It's more readable format, so it makes it easy to retrieve that data. We don't have to go through and do syslog and do cut and paste. So this should be a much more efficient way for you to gather information. The next slide then, like I said, the sysout data set, that's easy to make those submissions. Contains that information. It's formatted. There's a new option we have now on the diagnose snap command, a sysout option. You can specify then where I want that sysout to go, what type of queue I want that for. So I can have a class. On the next page, I see the class options. So that's any JES output class. I can specify a limit as far as how many lines I want to have snapped out. And then also the format, what I want to display or long or location. And then the next series of slides are just some examples of that output. Those are in there for your viewing pleasure. I'm going to keep moving down. We've added support on snapping for L terms and nodes and users. Added those capabilities, so that's documented. Pretty much all the rest of this whole presentation is examples of the diagnosis command, new messages added, and then we also have an appendix that shows you all this command syntax. So in the sake of time, I will ignore all of those, let you look through those at your leisure. So I will conclude my presentation so Dennis has a chance to continue with part three.
Okay, I'm off of mute. I'm going to talk about the presentation labeled IMS 13 System Part 3. Your first slide should read Concurrent Application Thread Enhancements. Going on to the slide labeled 2 on mine, the next one. First enhancement I want to talk about is Partition Specification Tables, or PSTs. A little bit of background there, just so everyone's aware. These are used for active dependent regions, the BMPs, IFPs, JMPs, JVP message regions. They're also used for CICS and DB control threads and open database access threads. More on history. IMSers have been around a long time, so we'll briefly go over this. 1980 in IMS 116, we introduced 31 dependent regions, which was an increase of almost 50%. 100% of the time, because we only had 15 prior to that. In 1995, we went to 999, effectively 1,000 regions. 2018 in IMS 13, we now have 4,095 dependent regions available, basically quadrupling the amount of work the PSTs are making available to you. Then we're going to talk a little bit about the related parameters in setting that up. Max PST, PST, max threads for ODBM, max threads and minimum threads for DB control. Next slide. Max PST parameter. This one is used for DBC, DCC, and IMS procedures, and what it does is it specifies the maximum number of PSTs that an online control region can initiate. Our default is still at 255. That hasn't changed. But our maximum value is now at the 4095 that we mentioned previously. And this is going to control the maximum number of regions. Also, the CICS DB control threads for users there and the open database access thread. If you need to, for any reason, reduce the max PST number that is defined in your proc line, it's going to require a cold start. Otherwise, the old value is going to be carried forward with an ERE and an NRE. Slide 4, our PST parameter. This is used in the DBC, DCC, and IMS procedures, and this specifies how many PSTs actually get initialized and allocated during IMS startup. This value can be anything from 0 and up to the max PST value. And the default here is 0. So if you're defaulted, when IMS starts up, it's not going to initiate a PST until it needs one. IMS is going to start adding PSTs as it's needed up to the total that you have specified in that max PST. It's going also going to unallocate PSTs as they're releasing. If you have a message region that you bring down and that PST is no longer needed, IMS will unallocate it, and it will decrease that value as low as up to that PST equals value that you've defined. The max threads parameter for open database. This here is specified in the CSLDC ODBM configuration proc 5 number. So this is where you're going to look for it. It's going to specify the maximum number of current active threads for an individual data store. It can be set globally for all connections or locally to a specific data store. So you have some control over how you want to allocate those threads connected to ODBM. The default value here is 1. And that value can be anywhere between 1 and what you specify as your max PST. Max threads and minimum threads parameters. For DB control, this is specified in the DFS PRP macro, and that's going to define the DRA startup table. Max thread, that's the number of maximum DRA threads, TCBs available at one time, and the minimum threads is the number of threads that's going to be available at one time. The maximum value, again, is as high as the max PST value specified, and our minimum value here is 1. I'm on slide number 7 for me, ODB MinThreads / MaxThreads. This is specifically talking about them in RRS, our Recoverable Resource Manager. In the CTPL DRA performance, excessive TCB and attach and detach. So we're changing the minimum thread to a value of 1 to 62% of the max thread automatically. This is going to improve your performance by reducing the attaching and detaching of threads. Now, we also retrofitted this to IMS 11 and IMS 12 with the APAR shown, 11 PM 63977 and 12 PM 63976. If you're using RRS equals Y, there's no change since ODBA TCBs are used. Our minimum thread is still default, but there's no attach or detach for DRA processing. Next slide, command considerations. For DRD commands, for transactions that do support the max region parameter of up to the max PST value, the following commands, create TRAN, TRAN description, update TRAN, and update TRAN description are valid and will include the new values. Our change TRAN command supports the max region parameter up to the max PST. If you're using the output display, type 1 command, the slash displays, TRAN command supports now supports up to that 4-digit decimal so that you can see how many are really there instead of the 3-digit number previously. A note here, if you are using and expect this on the Transact macro in your IMS gen, that macro still only supports a max region of 255, which is the current default. So if you need more assigned to a particular transaction, you'll have to do it through command. The SysGen will not support that. Some coexistence considerations for that. In a mixed version IMS Plex, where you have IMSs at different levels, and the max region parameter specify a value of greater than 99, passing validation at the OM level, because OM uses the highest version grammar, that will pass. However, if any of these commands are routed to an IMS that is a lower version than IMS 12, meaning that it does not support up to the 4095 PSTs, the affected commands are slash change, create for TRAN and TRAN description, and update for TRAN and TRAN description. Those will fail. So what are the benefits here? We now have increased capacity and scalability for all IMS systems. Larger capacities for mergers and acquisitions. Someone bringing in an IMS can all bring it under one control region now without having to add more IMS images. This means we can have increased workloads and room for vertical growth. More regions for IMS 13. That helps improve synchronous program switch function, synchronous callout, distributed sync point, etc. Because more regions are available, the regions aren't going to get locked up for longer occupancies. They'll be more available. Other transaction processing can continue successfully. Basically, the bottom line here is max PST, the number of PSTs in your IMS, should no longer be a limiting factor in growing your IMS. Next slide, I'm on reduced total cost of ownership, TCO. This is not the time control option. There's reduced total cost of ownership. Next slide. One of the goals that we're trying to present and with IMS 13 is a reduced cost of ownership, making it more effective at the same resource value. So we've got a cross-platform focus on reducing mainframe software costs here, reducing software costs based on CPU usage. This is a major focus out of the development labs. Potential performance levels come out of this. So the lab's ongoing focus is reducing path lengths, optimizing frequency used processes, latch and lock improvements, storage reductions, and then taking advantage of the new hardware functions and the new Z Enterprise ZOS capabilities. Let's talk a little bit about those. On to the next slide. So I'm going to talk about a few of the specific enhancements, some general enhancements internally, the ability to use ZIP for certain functions, external subsystem access facility for Java-dependent regions. those will be in the subsequent slides. We'll talk about those. So let's go on. Next slide, specific reduced TCO enhancements. First off, the IMS log latch contention reduction. So we're starting improving the log latch and log buffer management for increased logging bandwidth, more efficient processing. Larger systems have a bottleneck during logging and checkpoint. Improving this will reduce that. Shared queues, local first optimization. This now applies on program-to-program switch messages as well as ordinary input messages. What that means is if the message has a program-to-program switch and IMS can process on the same IMS that the switch was initiated on, it will stay on that IMS. DB space management block serialization, BLS-ER latch improvements. What we've done there is split from single to multiple latches, improving heavy BMP workloads. Many users have BMP workloads that are extensive overnight. This should improve their performance over that. Next slide. Specific enhancements continue. Exploitation of pageable 1 megabyte pages. The ZEC12 processor with Flash Express provides the ability of paging 1 megabyte at a time as a single page. IMS 13 is going to take advantage of this for some storage pools and control box when it's available. It can improve performance, reducing the number of page steps in a dynamic translation, and look-aside buffer. It's a tremendous benefit being able to move that much pageable information back and forth. Next slide on the 17 on mine, specific reduced TCO enhancement. We have a large mnemonic here, MEM dataset NQ management exploitation. This function provides the benefits of jobs and subsystems to use memory-based dataset NQ management for dynamically allocated datasets instead of the old SWA-based dataset NQ management. It's faster than SQA, and it's intended for those jobs that allocate large number of data sets, such as IMS. If you want it enabled, it's a ZOS function. Dataset NQs are dynamically allocated data sets, are managed in memory, and improve that. So if you want to take advantage of this process, in your SysOne Parmlab member, AllocXX, whatever it happens to be, you set a MemDS NQ management to enable, and this will allow IMS 13 to take advantage of it, as well as whoever in the system needs it. Next slide, mine 18, other reduced TCO enhancements. Slide after that, OTMA, YTIB chain hash table. This is going to improve fine desk performance. Conversion of OTMA and IMS Connect storage call to a C pool in cross-memory services XRV exits. There is a note here. This does add 167 megabytes of virtual storage in E-private for IMS Connect and OTMA. This is a performance improvement in removing unnecessary clearing of buffers. We've got an improved SCC directory search algorithm in the DFS YCP00. And we've removed the IVSK insert virtual storage key instructions. We use branch relative processing for Common Queue Server now. Cache efficiency improvements. The DPSD blocks are packed into a single I page to keep references localized. All of this should be major benefit in performance. Other things we've done, IMS page load service algorithm is improved. There are IMS dispatcher optimizations. The OSAM cross-memory lock is reduced. We have general instruction optimization, replacing STKC STCK with STCKF, long displacement facility exploitation. We have eliminated the cache manager spin loop. The BPE or base primitive environment dispatcher hot cache line is prefetched. Elimination of local locks obtained around buffer fixing for OSAM buffers. All of these are also improvements in IMS 13. Okay, next slide is my 21, IMS zip utilization enhancement. This is a disclaimer. It's basically general descriptions. If you want more information, a couple slides later, there's the URL to look it up. I think it's also here, system support machine warranties code. Let's just move on to the next slide. The overview here, some processes in IMS Connect address spaces and the Open Database Manager address space can be executed under Enclave Service Request Blocks, SRBs. When IMS determines, and it has to have it, the zip available online during address space initialization, IMS is going to direct the OS to authorize that work to be processed on an available zip. So the purpose here is basically to move that processing from a billable CPU to a non-billable CPU. Overall cost here, including IMS SOAP gateway, direct IMS DB access, MSC and ISC using TCP/IP. So this is all going to reduce overall costs for selected workloads like we just discussed. Okay, unless it's noted in the, moved on to slide 23, utilization enhancement, except otherwise described in the black below, IMS Connect and ODBM process can execute under SRB enclave in version 13. Well, processing IMS Connect address space SOAP messages threads, disincluded. Processing of IMS Connect and ODBMM DRDA requests, processing of Connect using MSC coupling through MSC messages arriving via TCP/IP. Processing IMS Connect address intersystem coupling, ISC, also for ISC messages arriving via TCP/IP. And the processing of ODBMM address space threads for requests arriving through the CFLDMI API. A note here, any user exits that are called by the build processing will not execute in the enclave SRB. All user exits are going to be processed under task control block mode, TCB. That means they will not be eligible because they're not SRB. Next slide. The zip automatically active when you start an IMS Connect or an IMS ODBMM address space if one or more online zip processors are available on your ZOS. The zip processor has to be online when your Connect or ODBMM regions are started. If IMS detects that it's not there, the two address spaces then are non-zip eligible. So if you're planning on using zip, you have to make sure the processors are enabled. There's no system definition necessary, no changes you need to make there. Any user exits, again, called by zip-eligible threads will not execute under SRB. They're given control in TCP mode. So they're not going to be authorized to process on the zip. Next slide. Configuring the BPE for zip processing. Gives you some provision of how to control your zips. If you disable SRB mode and thus zip initialization completely, even if the zip processors are available, it's going to not run in zip. If you want it to run in zip, enable SRB mode processing for the threads, even when no zips are there. What you've done at that point is enable an option in SIS1 TarmLib, the IEA OptXX member, called Project CPU. And this will give you an idea of how much processing could be moved over to a zip, even if the zip is not available. In default mode, we're using SRB mode and at least one zip online at BP initialization. Otherwise, we're going to go to TCB mode. So how do we control that? Next slide. If you just want to disable SRB mode processing and zip utilization, we have a parameter in the BPE configuration proc live member called CONSRB, conditional SRB. Here we're looking at never / comma HWS, and this is going to disable it for IMS Connect. For ODBMM, we use CONSRB never comma ODBM, and that will disable it for ODBM processing. Next slide. This is the reverse of that. If you know you have zips and you want to use them, we're going to have a new configuration proclive parameter, an additional SRB always, comma HWS, this is for IMS Connect, and always, comma ODBM for ODBM processing. So once those parameters are in your BPE member, you can simply restart and that processing will be available, provided the zip is online. Default mode, which you could code, no condition SRB is needed for a default mode. However, in either case, we have a conditional SRB of CON for conditional. If the zip is available online, the address regions will use it. If it's not, they won't. Otherwise, we switch back to TCB mode. Some maintenance considerations for ZOS if you're planning on using ZIP. ZOSA PAR 0839392, if you're under ZOS 13. This applies when you have conditional SRB always or conditional SRB equals condition. Provides improved management of the abnormally terminating SRBs. You do not need any APAR for ZOS 2.1 or above. Okay, next slide. I'm on slide 30 of mine. The benefits. Selected workloads, including SOAP Gateway, Direct IMS DB Access, MSC and ISC over TCP/IP, take advantage of ZIP processors, therefore lower your software costs. Example of IMS exploitation of System Z, great benefits for IMS customers. So if you're looking for more information on the Integrated Information Processor or ZIP, here's the URL. ibm.com/system/z/zip. That will provide you a bunch of information about that. Next slide, ESAF support in Java-dependent regions. And on to slide 32. Prior to IMS 13, the only external subsystem ESS that JDR applications could use, could access, is DB2 using DB2 RRF attach facility. No access other than external subsystems such as WebSphere. DB2 RRSAF usage was unique to the JDR versus the other type of regions, and it was a more complex external definition. So addressing a need for consistent ESAF interface across all regions for DB2 and the need for a less complex external subsystem definition, this is what we're doing. So with IMS on the next slide, there are two methods of accessing DB2 from JDRs, Java-dependent regions. We can now access previously existing RRSAF interface or the standard ESAF interface. The support for the SSM macro parameter, SSM equals parameter on dependent region startup JCO, there's an example of that a little further on. And only one ESS connection per JMP or JBP. The default connection is still DB2 RRSAF, so there's no impact to existing users. If you need to specify ESAF as the connection method, specify the SSM equals in the Java-dependent region JCL. So this provides an additional method for accessing DB2 and the same method as non-JDR region types. So in this essence, we're making it a little bit easier for folks, providing a more efficient and a less complex connection method to get to DB2. ESA support in Java-dependent regions. ESA interface for version 13 can be used with JMP or JBP regions, access any ESAF defined IMS control region. That's WebSphere MQ, DV2, the optimized local adapter. You implement that using the SSM parameter on the dependent region startup JCO. Note that there's only one external subsystem connection method allowed per JMP or JVP region. Again, our default is for DV2 is the RRSAF, so there's no impact to the existing users. And if you need the new one, you'll have to specify the SSM macro, parameter on a control region. We now provide the support all ESAF interfaces. WebSphere MQ and WOA can now be accessed via the JMP and JVP regions. All right, to enable it, we do the SSM equals parameter on the DFS JMP procedure and the DFS JVP procedure. So there's an example of those later. We also have to ensure that the DV statement DFS ESL is included in the JCL, otherwise we're going to fail. It's documented in the IMS library, and we have here on this slide on 35 the information center. We have worked and are almost converted over to the knowledge center, which has the latest and greatest information. I believe the links will automatically take you there if you do a Google or that type of search. They'll direct you to the knowledge center now, which has the same information. So here's a sample of our procedure on slide 36. This is the JMP procedure. Note in the highlighted blue, SSM equals, and at the very bottom, we've added the statement, the DD statement, DFS, ESL. Next slide, 37, the same thing for our JVP procedure. And on to slide 38, our benefits here for Java ESAF support Java-dependent regions. These regions now use a standard external subsystem attach facility for all DV2 for ZOS, WebSphere MQ, and WOA. Listing here provide a consistent external subsystem interface, simplified external subsystem definitions. It's an easier implementation than the RRS attach facility, more efficient also compared to that. And we're providing Java Method Services, JMS, access to MQ from IMS Java applications. Providing ESA access to WebSphere MQ or WOA from a COBOL or PLO1 program. That was called from a Java application running in one of the dependent regions. Okay, my slide 31, IMS 13 service process changes. Next slide on that. APAR PM 86872, timing services and connection to external subsystems. Currently, application programs that ran in a dependent region using S-timer may not be terminated with that user 244 if they make an external subsystem call that's quite extended. Basically, what happened then was the U240 was delayed until after that information was returned from the external subsystem. Then IMS popped the timer and it would admit. The change with this APAR makes is it's now that admin, the timeout, 240, will now be enforced in a dependent region that was running an external subsystem when time expires using IMS timing services. It's no longer going to wait for the external subsystem. So this is something that you may have to look at either with your automation or application programming. Next slide, APAR PM 81408, persistent JVM in dependent regions where the Java application makes a DV2 call through the DV2 JCC. Our change is the environment equals proclog member parameter description. We have a new control card here, DV2 JCC connection reuse equals yes or N. This parameter is going to specify whether or not you want IMS, the DV2 JCC, to communicate that the connection should be reused if possible for the next transaction. The default here is N. It's only recognized for an MPP, BMP, and IFP. A note if this parameter is specified as Y, the DB2-JCC connection will only be reused if the transaction user ID for the next transaction is the same as the previous user ID for the for that transaction. In order for this to appropriately work with DB2, there are two APARs dependent upon the region. The version of JCC, PM77184 for JCC 3.64 and PM77185 for JCC 4.14. Just a note of that if you're using those and wish to have your connections being reused. Next slide. User 101 description, PM81408. The change here, description section in PCC 20 of the messages of the code manuals is added for version 12 and above only. Basically, we're talking about some of the diagnostic information that is created when the advent occurs. Register 6 and 7 contain the field of the RC-PGM program name at the time of the advent, and you're going to have a reason code in returned in register 15, FX 5. If register 3 is a 0 Charlie, you're going to get a DFS 650E preceding this advent, something for automation folks if they need to take a look at that. Next slide. APAR PM81408, the 650E description, basically talking about a non-LE compliant program in a persistent JVM environment with its explanation there. Basically, you loaded a non-compliant LE program or a program that did not have LE linked into it. Any program executing in a JVM environment must be LE compliant and conforming, otherwise this advent will occur. System action and programmer response, I'm sure you can go over that. Next slide. PM90903, persistent JVM feature for dependent regions. A cancel program parameter. Currently, cancel program, if you specified the parameter as Y, it only takes effect after the application has terminated on a unit of work boundary. The change is going to specify whether or not you want IMS to clean up those COBOL programs and subprograms per commit cycle. So if you specify it as the parameter as Y, it's going to work on a dependent region, boundary of work, unit of work boundary, as it did before. If you specify cancel program N, which is a default value, IMS will not clean up all the programs and subprograms. The working storage is going to remain intact for your next program execution, something an application may have to look at. Next slide. IPAR PM78158 for dependent regions, the PAR DLI capability. Currently, we have PAR DLI equals 1 for BNPs, and this means that all DLI processing is to be performed in the control region. And this basically prevents your system 113 admins resulting from canceling the BNP. The change that this APAR makes is going to provide an ability to specify the PAR DLI parameter for JMP, MPP, and IFP regions, meaning that that processing is going to be performed in the control region. So this is a big note. This is if you use PAR DLI equals 1 for MPPs, JMPs, and IFPs, it could seriously degrade your performance. So here we recommend using PAR DLI 1 for dependent regions. It's intended for application debugging purposes if it is needed. Okay, I'm at the end of my presentation. We ran a little bit over from our schedule. I'd like to remind people that there is a survey out there. We'd like you to take the survey on how we did, and we are now turning it back over to April to open for questions. If anyone has questions, now is the time.
Thank you. And once again, if you would like to ask a question, simply press the star key followed by the digit 1 on your telephone keypad. Also, if you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. And once again, that is star 1. We'll pause for a moment. And it appears there are no questions at this time. Would you like to proceed with the survey?
Yes.
Okay, and now we would like to ask you to participate in a brief electronic survey. Your feedback is important to us, and we do appreciate the time you take to answer these questions. To participate, simply press the star key followed by the number that best corresponds to your choice. Please listen to all options before making your selection. And once again, to participate in this survey, you simply press the star key followed by the number that best corresponds to your choice. Please listen to all options before making your selection. And for our first question, please evaluate your level of satisfaction with today's teleconference. If it was high, press star 1. If it was medium, press star 2. If it was low, press star 3. Question 2, was the level of technical information presented in this teleconference? If it was at the right level, press star 1. If it was not technical enough, press star 2. If it was more technical than I needed to hear, press star 3. And for our next question, what version of IMS do you currently have in production? If IMS 10, press star 1. If IMS 11, press star 2. If IMS 12, press star 3. Question 4, when do you plan to migrate to IMS 13? If you have already migrated to IMS 13, press star 1. If in the next 6 months, press star 2. If 12 or more months away, press star 3. Question 5, would you like more information about IBM service offerings for migrating to IMS 13? If yes, press star 1. If no, press star 2. If not sure or need more information, press star 3. Question 6. We hope you have enjoyed the teleconference today. Please let us know if you are interested in receiving information on this solution. If yes, press star 1. If no info is desired at this time, press star 2. And that does conclude our survey for today. Thank you all for participating. I would now like to turn the conference back over to our presenters for any additional or closing comments.
Thank you very much, everybody.
Yeah, thank you very much.
And this does conclude today's conference. Please remember to join us tomorrow for day 2 of the IMS 13 Technical Education on Enhancements and Migration Planning teleconference series.